This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everyone. It is time for episode 4. That's numero cuatro. If you're a Latino or Spanish speaker, or somebody who's multilingual or bilingual of the Trademarks podcast, we've been on a slightly longer than planned hiatus. I am Dylan Hales with my co-host David Bixenspan, the world famous David Kaleidoscope, I should say. Really, yes. That's his claim to fame. In fact, we may rebrand the show around that. I was looking for a sort of clever way of integrating childhood toys into the themes of tonight's show, but I really don't have any good Etch-a-Sketch jokes. Maybe it'll come to me as we go forward. This is, like I said, we're a little bit behind schedule. I've had some craziness going on in my life personally, and having to move, and some health issues and things like that. So we apologize for the delay. But having said that, we're back in the saddle again, and I think we have a pretty cool show tonight with some very – we don't have a ton of things to talk about. It's not like we have a huge slate of
– No, but it's different from the first few shows, I think, especially the first two shows. Yeah,
it's very different, and what's cool about it is, you know, for those who aren't familiar, and this is your first time listening, whether it be at davidbix.com or at voicesofwrestling.com, this show is – a show that deals with aspects of professional wrestling that are a little bit outside the purview of what you would hear on a normal podcast. We deal with things like intellectual property rights, pro wrestling business models, from whether it's independents or t-shirt companies or anything in between. And we also deal with sort of weird legal issues as well, things that maybe don't get covered as much inside the wrestling press. So today we have a few of those things that sort of, I think almost everything will be covered and touched upon in one way or another. I don't know that we will get super deep into a lot of peripheral stuff, but we do have three main topics we want to get to today. So before we get deeply invested in the content, Mr. Kaleidoscope, do you have anything you'd like to share with us at the top of the show today?
No.
I hope your contributions to tonight's show are as verbose and exciting as that. I hope that's the standard for the evening as we move forward.
So what are we starting with, NWA Classics then?
I think we should start with NWA Classics. We didn't do a run sheet this time, but I think NWA Classics is probably the biggest picture story in some ways, because it combines sort of our love, you and I say, but more generally speaking, a lot of our listeners, for classic old school wrestling footage. You know, on the first show we talked about kind of how podcasts like this and newsletters and the entire smart fan culture, for lack of a better term, completely flows out of tape trading, which of course is effectively piracy. But in this instance, what we have is the famous Mr. Bruce Tharp of NWA and New Japan fame, who has access to Paul Bosch's private library from the Houston promoter Paul Bosch. And he started this website, and he's brought forward a lot of content that had never before been seen. So I know for a fact that you have already subscribed to this service, and you've seen a lot of the stuff. I have, and I'm actually going to subscribe on Friday. So I'm going to let you talk a little bit about some of the content. But before we get into the content, let's talk a little bit about the model itself. I mean, what exactly is the model price point wise? I think is it $8.99 a month, and then like a yearly plan? How does that work, David?
Yeah, so I think officially it is $8.99 a month, or maybe $99 for a year if you buy it in advance. Now, the thing they're one thing they're doing, which I am not a fan of, and I really not a fan of when anyone does this, because you just bake it into your price point, is that they are charging extra for the credit card processing fees. It's not a make or break for me whether this is $9 or $10, but come on, just charge the price that includes the fees. That's actually my that might be my biggest complaint so far. Like, I don't understand why you would do that unless it's just the processor and whatever they're using.
Yeah, that is odd. You'd think you just embed that in the price. I mean, it's possible that there's a specific reason it has to be done. I don't want to say that it's lazy, because it very well could be that they have to do it that way for one reason or another. It's not like we're talking about a huge corporation here, but I do think that's a little odd in this day and age, where you could easily just embed that in the price. And that is the sort of thing that could potentially turn off people too, who think they're getting charged X amount, and then they look and there's an extra buck or whatever thrown on the top.
Yeah,
so
it was like 74 cents for me or something. I mean, like I said, it's not a make or break, because it probably would have gotten it at the higher price. It just doesn't look good. It's off-putting. It's not – it just doesn't feel right.
Now, I don't want to dwell too much on the complaints.
No. I mean, I do think we should get them out of the way quickly, though.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is the service, I think – pretty much everybody who has the service that I know, and I know quite a few people who've ordered it, they love the footage itself. But we do have to address a couple of the complaints. That's number one. I think the most common complaint has to do with the ratio size or whatever the footage. I am not a person who knows anything about this sort of thing. This is not my bread and butter. This seems like it's something that's more in your wheelhouse. Yes. So I'm going to defer to you on that, so you can explain to an idiot like me what exactly the stretching means and how it has affected your enjoyment of viewing these matches that Bruce Tharp and NWA Classics have put up.
Okay, so it's 70s and 80s videotaped pro wrestling, so it is the 4:3 aspect ratio, the old, you know, regular, almost square tube TV, you know, aspect ratio that we're all familiar with. That's what the footage was originally. And WWE, at least when they air stuff like that now, you know, since most people have widescreen TVs or all new stuff's widescreen, etc., they do what's called pillar boxing, the opposite of letter boxing, which was what was done with widescreen, where they put pillar boxing is when you put bars on the side, black bars or sort of illustrated bars or whatever, because you want to have the full picture without manipulating it, and that's how you do it. You know, letterboxing, of course, being if you have something that is too wide for the display, then you put bars on the top and bottom. And even now, movies that are widescreen are still wider than the ratio used for TV sets. So you still see, like, if you get a Blu-ray of a, you know, major movie, a lot of them are still letterboxed. So WWE deals with it with pillar boxing. I mean, if you get a Criterion Collection or anything that's a TV show that was shot in 4:3, usually now, like, it is letterboxed if it's being presented in a widescreen presentation. They did not do that. They stretched it. Now, if you've ever tried to stretch something on your TV to fill it up, and I know some people do it because they have like an older plasma TV or something where you can't have the black bars there too long. But generally speaking, I mean, especially now that plasmas are pretty much dead, it's really not something you should do. It looks crappy if you stretch it to fill the screen. You know, everyone looks too wide, etc. Now, and also, like, if you watch shows on, like, the HD versions of TBS or TNT that were just videotaped 4:3 shows, they do that too, and they do it badly. Like, if you ever watch, like, when I'm just flipping channels around, like, Charmed, I think, on TNT looks like that, and Roseanne on Wii, and just trying to think of what I see that looked stretched these days. And also, you know, of course, your TV has a button to let you do that. That's not what they did, though. They did what's called a progressive stretch, which means in the middle of the screen, they don't really stretch it, and then as it gets further out, with the idea being it's old wrestling on a hard camera, most of it's going to be around the middle, then they start to stretch a lot more towards the edges. I was not crazy about it when I first saw the teaser and stuff, though I understood that it was better than a normal stretch. That said, watching the footage so far, it hasn't really bothered me. And I'm someone who's kind of a stickler on that.
Yeah, I would have expected that it would bother you because I do know you, and now I have seen people who said, oh, I can't watch it because it gives me a headache or whatever. And I look, that I am the absolute wrong person to talk to about that sort of thing, because as somebody who was so big into tape trading, to me, I've seen so many things that were of absolutely awful video quality that I do not care. It does not matter. I would rather the footage be out there. I don't care what the quality is. The fact that the quality of the footage itself appears to be, for the most part, very good, if not better, is my concern less than whether or not the image itself was stretched for whatever reason. But I did want to mention that because it's something that is
right.
Come
and that's
up.
Had Bruce Tharp is clearly listening and responding to most, if not all, feedback.
Yes. Yeah. He's been quite good at that, really. It seems to be the case.
And it seems like he's looking into also doing it at 4:00 to 3:00, because, I mean, it's not any extra work, too. So, I mean, I don't think there's any reason not to do it. I mean, the only other complaint has been, to some degree, the added commentary that him, and I keep forgetting the name of the guy, he's from the local NWA promotion in Texas, that's doing the commentary on matches that didn't have commentary because they weren't aired originally. I think, honestly, they're doing a pretty solid job. They sound like even though, like, Bruce is, I asked Bruce and he said he's not doing it consciously. I feel like their styles sound close enough to be, to Paul Bosch and Peter Barkholz that it's not distracting unless they talk too much about the matches being in past tense. It's not always dubbed in great in terms of the audio levels and stuff, but it hasn't really been distracting or a problem that I've seen. I saw I just wanted to finish my thought.
Sure.
I did see one person say that, like, on the Shawn Michaels versus John Nord match, that they were dubbing over the original announcing, but I'm pretty sure there was no original announcing there.
What I was going to say is most of these don't have original announcing, correct?
It just depends. If it didn't air on TV originally, it doesn't have original announcing. If it did air on TV, it has Paul Bosch or Peter Burkholz doing commentary.
See, my thought is, if the original announcing is there, I don't think it should be dubbed over.
No, that doesn't seem like they are.
So that would be my main thing. But I'm the kind of person, personally, I don't mind watching wrestling with no commentary. In fact, sometimes I kind of enjoy it.
Yeah.
Having said that, if you're trying to present this as a professional product to the masses, I think having commentary over it is almost an essential thing. I don't think you can leave it out. I don't think because the average person isn't a person like me who sits in front of YouTube and watches random handhelds from obscure independent promotions. I mean, you need something. You need a voice that people can identify with, that is maybe going to fill in the gaps, whether it be history or context of the performers involved. I really feel like that is absolutely an essential thing. So even if the commentary itself is just okay, and I don't know, but even if it's just okay, I feel like it's a good thing. The only way it would be a net negative for me would be if the commentary was awful. And in today's wrestling climate, I can't imagine that Tharp and whoever's partner is any worse than what we get on average from a lot of promotions. So yes. To me, I can't imagine it being anything other than a positive. Now, one other thing
I do want to ask you one thing about
sure.
that, though.
Yes, go ahead.
What's your preference? Doing new commentary as if the match is live and a worked pro wrestling match happening right now, or acknowledging that it's a match from the past and depending on the attitude? Because I think these are all calling it as if wrestling is a sport, but what's your preference? Calling it as if it's live like Jim Ross did for the Mid-South DVD for WWE, or acknowledging that it's a match from the past?
I personally feel that in this case, where the name of the product you're purchasing is NWA Classics, and it is marketed as something that is for fans, who are fans of classic wrestling, older wrestling, the pre-WWE style of wrestling, for lack of a better way of putting it. To me, I think announcing in the rear view, if you want to put it that way, is actually preferable. Because I don't mind the idea. Like, it's not like voiceovers bother me or things like that. That's completely different. But it I think a lot of people who are watching this from the perspective of they're interested in the history. And as long as it doesn't veer too far into the territory of like something like a an alternate commentary on a DVD, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like as long as it doesn't veer too far down that rabbit hole, then I actually prefer that they treat it as if it's happened in the past, mainly because of the way it's marketed. To me, it's a little bit different because I've seen it both ways. Like I've seen I think it was the Loose stuff where they do the commentary of the Chicago clippings, right? And some of that stuff is commentated as if it's happening right then, and it just comes across as really lame. You're like, eh, come on, dude, the match is clipped. You know, like, give me a break. There was just a
film that
10-minute clip.
It's film that's edited with, I think, the Bob Loose crowd noise is dubbed in, right?
Yes.
Or on some
a lot of it,
at least. Yeah.
Yes.
So, to me,
that's just so dishonest. Like, I mean, I expect wrestling to be a carny enterprise. Don't get me wrong. My door's about to slam, by the way. But thanks to my cat for that. But I expect wrestling to be something of a carny enterprise because that's what it is, right? But to me, that's a bridge too far. Like, that's like basically saying you people are stupid, and I know it. And so I prefer the rear view announcing or whatever term you want to use. Like to me, it's not a deal breaker either way, as long as the commentary is up to a certain level. Like as long as the commentary is not bad. But that's just me. I do want to mention a couple of quick things before we start talking about the content that you've watched and what some of your takeaways are from that and the things that maybe were not previously available. And that is two things that were brought up. Bruce Tharp was interviewed by our good friend Pete from Titans of Wrestling over the PWO, PTBN Podcasting Network. It's a really cool interview. And, you know, he basically said that in the future they might be looking at streaming some live events from local NWA promotions. And they might be looking at doing, like, DVDs, like Blu-ray DVD sets for Andre the Giant matches from Houston or Nick Bockwinkel matches from Houston. I want to get your thoughts on both of those because I think the idea of adding other promote. I mean, I think that was probably the idea all along was to use this classic footage to try and squeeze in some more modern NWA.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of doing streaming other shows because I'm a big fan of and supporter of modern independent pro wrestling. So to me, that's a really cool idea. And that's actually, frankly, that's far more likely to make me want to fork over the $100 for the yearly subscription.
Did
than
you
the
just
classic
drink some video? Coffee in the middle of our conversation?
I didn't. Am I getting hyper? Am I getting hyped up?
Because you're getting like incredibly hyped up all of a sudden.
Because I think this is interesting. I think this
is yes,
really cool. But the Blu-ray idea, though, I think is kind of a bad idea.
We did a show about that.
And I get why you would want to do it, and I get like if this is something that you were selling at like a gimmick table at a show, like for like a you know $7. I could see that. I think there's value in that still. But because you can produce them on the cheap and you don't have to worry about mailing them off. You don't have to worry about trying to get a distributor like we talked about with Kevin Kleinrock on the last show. Like it's a much easier way to – but I think those are two very different ideas. So are you on board with me in thinking that one is a good idea and the other is bad?
Oh, yeah. I mean I don't think there's any disagreement between us on those.
Yeah, I just wanted to get that out of the way because we're looking at the business model here, and I really like the idea of streaming new stuff. I think that's a really cool idea, and I like I like what they've been doing with the slow release. So, or the future plan for the slow release, I should say, of a match a day or whatever. So, why don't you talk about that some, and then talk about the new finds and the new things that have come out already on this service.
I mean, one last relatively minor negative I did want to get out of the way, though.
Sure.
I don't know if you've looked at it yet, because I know you didn't sign up yet, but the website is not the most navigable thing.
Yeah, I've heard
that. It's difficult to figure out how to sign up, which is really should be the easiest thing to do. I mean, I say that I was able to figure it out, but for their sake, I really want them to... Wait a second, was Hector Guerrero versus Dr. Death in a singles match up before? That sounds
weird. I don't know. I don't think so.
That's okay, because that's listed all of a sudden. That's under latest content. What day did they say they'd start adding a match a day?
That I don't know. In fact, I don't know that he ever did say that. I mean, the plan originally,
like
you know.
Did. So let's talk about that now. So I believe they launched with 50 matches is what he was saying?
Yes.
They launched with 50 different matches, and the plan is they will start adding a match a day. I want to say it was the middle of this month, although they may have just started doing it. And then if it's not the middle of the month, then it's the beginning of August. But I think it's the middle of this month. And I think, given that they have a limited amount and they need to try to drag this out for their own sake, but I think that's a perfectly fine way to do it. And in my head, and I know Phil Snyder's doing his reviews with the dollar value, like, I think of it comparing it to something like Click Wrestle, where I'm fine with paying a dollar a match if it's something I know I'll enjoy. So I don't have any problem with that, especially if I know they have a plan. Which, you know, I mean, WWE didn't give us any kind of plan for what they do with older stuff or anything, or really anything.
Oh, God, no. I think this model is much preferred. I actually really like it. I prefer it to just dumping a bunch of stuff out there, because what it does is it gives you something to look forward to. And it has kind of a grab bag effect to it, which might alienate some people, but to me makes it cool. Like, I like the idea of not knowing, like, what are you going to get the next day? Oh, shit, I got a Pat Rose match. I actually happen to like Pat Rose. but some people might be like, oh, it's only Pat Rose. But in the next day, you might get a Geno match, or you might get a Terry Fox. I think that is actually a plus for the service, because another thing that it does is it showcases the diversity of these Houston wrestling cards, which were among the most diverse and interesting cards in wrestling during this time period as covered. But it does it in a way where it's not overwhelming. You know, and I think that's actually one of the smarter things about this model. I really think that's a cool idea, frankly.
That said, though, they do need to be better with dates. And I feel like if for stuff where they have full shows, and I mean, there's already a full show they put up from 79, you know, the different matches. But I think they should try to be mindful that people might want to watch it that way.
I have mixed feelings about that.
I mean, they're already putting it up, though.
Yeah, if you're already putting up the whole show, sure. I agree. I kind of agree in that regard. Like, maybe I don't know if it's possible to do a playlist function. I don't know how that would work. But it's well above my pay grade when it comes to technology. But, you know, I feel like that's something that it maybe should be an option down the road. But I really like the grab bag effect. I think that's a cool way of doing it. I think it's a different way of doing it. I think it's already yielded some pretty cool stuff. I mean, granted, the first drop of stuff was largely a dump, but I do think they may have added a few things here and there. So what are – I mean, you don't necessarily have to run them all down. And I know the big elephant in the room is, of course, the Andre Harley Race 2 out of 3 Falls match. But what are the big – this has never been around before finds that we have so far from this service?
Okay. But, yeah, obviously the big one is Harley Race versus Andre the Giant for the NWA title from a Houston Summit show, which also is kind of notable – well, because that was not their regular venue. That meant it was a that meant it was a super show as opposed to being at the Sam Houston Coliseum. And that is also the show where the full show is up. And I'm trying to find the results because it's a super loaded card. So it's just interesting to get that feel for it.
That was in late 79, correct?
It was either early 79 or late 79. I'm trying to remember. It was January 79.
Okay.
So here we go. This whole card is up. I mean, I think this is the whole card. So this is January 7th, 1979. So Harley Race versus Andre the Giant, Ox Baker versus Gino Hernandez, Dusty Rhodes versus Mark Lewin in a no DQ brass knuckles title match, Superstar Billy Graham versus Tiger Conway Jr., Apache Bull Ramos versus Nick Kozak, and Mil Máscaras and Jose Lothario versus Dorian Terry Funk.
Which is a very diverse card. I think it's a card that really, again, it illustrates how I don't want to say crazy, but how different Houston wrestling cards could be relative
we should talk about that too. That first, because Houston's probably unlike any other town, because it's not like Toronto or St. Louis in that it was just a town. It was part of territories, but even when it was, he would use guys from outside. So what's the best way to explain this? Like, if you've read Gary Hart's book, anyone that has, that has the best explanation of the whole thing, but the gist is that originally going through the late 60s, Houston was the center of and it was where the booking office for Texas was based out of. Except for West Texas, which was the Funk's Amarillo promotion, you had Dallas, San Antonio, and Corpus Christi, and the spot towns being booked out of Houston. And, you know, there was the wrestling war, Fritz won, the booking office moved to Dallas. Houston then started booking guys out of Dallas. But Paul Bosch always liked to book in outside talent, book different angles, different gimmicks. Like, one of the more infamous ones is that when John Studd was in Texas, Paul Bosch felt that if this guy was wearing a mask in New York, they must know best, so let's put him under a mask. And that's why he was Captain USA, but only in Houston. And then later on, you know, he always had the some of the outside stuff, but then he fell out with the Dallas office. Joe Blanchard had split away. He started booking from Joe Blanchard again, booking some other talent too, and then eventually went to Mid-South. Again, not booking as many outside guys, but also working with World Class a little bit, and then finally switching to the WWF at the end.
Yeah, and I think on top of all that, which was about as good a bullet point synopsis as you're going to get, really, it's worth remembering that Paul Bosch had probably the best reputation of any promoter in the United States. I mean, you could argue maybe Don Owen, and you could
even throw in Vince Senior.
Yeah, you could argue Vince Senior. I think maybe, but he was in the, you know, that tier of places that the guys liked to work because the payoffs were good, and you know, for he whatever reason, Bosch was seen as just a more stand-up, respectable promoter as opposed to a slime ball, which is how a lot of them were viewed.
I mean, he was a unique guy for wrestling, though. He was a very smart guy. He was a poet. You know what I mean? Like, he was not a typical pro wrestler. I don't say that mean to slight any older or current pro wrestlers when I say that, but you get the idea.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to throw that in there because that also kind of explains why you get some of these diverse shows, because people wanted to work for him. You know, it's not like he was, you know, it's easier to get dates on guys when everybody loves you.
Yes.
So especially with the big name. So, okay, we've got you know, the aforementioned card from early 1979. What else do we have? I mean, it seems from reading Phil Schneider's reviews at ZagundaKaita.blogspot.com that the big takeaway for a lot of people is the Gino Hernandez stuff, which has been really awesome. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let's start with Gino. So I certainly never disliked Gino Hernandez. I always liked his work, but the stuff we had seen was mainly the San Antonio stuff with Tully Blanchard and the Dallas stuff with Chris Adams, both as the dynamic duo. And that stuff's really good to great, but he's always perceived, you know, he's generally been perceived as the guy who was Chris Adams' lesser partner, but the better promo, etc. Sort of a East-West connection type dynamic, I guess?
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty fair comparison.
Although, like with the East-West connection, I mean, still, Gino, well, like with the East-West connection, Adams was certainly a better promo than he got credit for, the same way Adonis was. Although, unlike Ventura, who's probably a worse wrestler than he got credit for, Gino, even in that context, was a better wrestler than he got
credit for. Yeah, nobody thought Gino was Jesse level.
No, but his reputation had been a guy who was not that good.
Yes. And
maybe
I have
not among wrestlers, but certainly among the hardcore fans.
And I have a theory about this, which I shared on Twitter.
Well, now, did you hear what Dave Meltzer said when I asked this question on Sin Limite this weekend?
I did not. And I'll let you frame it. You can go
ahead.
Let me
say that first.
Sure.
He said it was a matter of Gino coasting later on.
I find that hard to believe. Just like Jumbo was lazy, Dick Murdoch dogged it on house
shows. But he's not as good in that later stuff, whether it's drugs or whatever. But I can see that. I mean,
sure, but I am suspicious.
But he's
of
good
any...
enough in the Dallas and stuff that it still doesn't feel quite right. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm just suspicious of any narrative, and I'm not picking on Dave Meltzer.
No.
But I'm suspicious of any narrative that's that old that's not based on, like, revisiting footage.
But I did think your theory was pretty valid, so go ahead.
Yeah, well my theory is that Gino is a guy who's very comparable to both Michael Hayes and Roddy Piper in the sense that very early on in his career, because really all three of those guys are kind of archetypical guys.
They all started very young,
all representative of a certain image. and a certain almost stereotype of whatever. And all three of those guys got reputations of having being super charismatic and really great talkers, like from very early ages, you know. And I think what happened is because those guys, none of them were smooth, traditionally smooth workers. They kind of were a little bit awkward in how they took bumps. Their offensive delivery wasn't like the Dynamite Kid. It wasn't super sharp or whatever. So I think what happened is the narrative sort of became, well, these guys are great talkers, but they're not great wrestlers, because they were so good at talking and they were unconventional in their movements that it, you know, people didn't, they just kind of got put in those boxes. But if you go back and watch the footage with the benefit of hindsight and without worrying about whatever narrative came out of smart fan culture 30 years ago, I feel like all three of those guys are much better than their reputations were coming out of that era as in-ring performers. I think all three of those guys, in my view, are actually great wrestlers in the ring.
And
so,
also, well, and Michael Hayes also had the whole Bill Watts added Buddy Roberts to the Freebirds.
Yes.
He couldn't work, which he was super green and young, and he was also being compared to Terry Gordy, so whatever.
Which is a tough comparison, a literal child prodigy, you know. So, you know, yeah. That's my view on that. But we've got, I mean, there is several Geno matches that have come. So, what are the Geno matches?
So, I mean, do you want to start with the matches I've watched that I already?
Why don't I start with
that? Because I also had post about them at PWO. So, Geno versus Jose Lothario actually did exist before, because it had aired on the Bosch Best of Texas Wrestling show that was on Satellite Program Network, which later became Tempo, which had a bunch of wrestling shows in the 80s. And that had been floating around. I mean, not a lot, but, you know, Phil mentioned that he hadn't even known it existed. It wasn't something that people talked about, really. So I had seen that before. I remember really enjoying it, but it was even better than I remembered. So this is, yeah, okay. Geno versus Jose Lothario. They just called the defense match, which is, it's a Texas Death steel cage match. And it is just, this made me want to watch more Jose Lothario, which maybe turned out to be a mistake. But this is from, this is from 79. Geno just looks like just a super complete heel, and, you know, just great bumping, facials, getting heat, everything to get heat, bleeding, etc. Just everything he does. And Jose Lothario was a very good older baby face, great punches. What's the word I'm looking for? You know what I mean? He was just had this, because, I mean, that's the thing. We don't have a lot of Jose Lothario, like, even post-prime. I mean, like, we have some, like, his pro, like, because he was also supposed to be a really good promo, too, and we don't really have much. Because he had this, like, he had a very unique promo style, too. Like, how much have you seen?
Very little.
Like, the little I've seen was on those reels that I got converted, which was, again, from the end. That was, like, from 83, 84, when he was, like, helping promote the world-class spot shows in Spanish-speaking markets. And this, like, very stern, like, fatherly, like, promo style, but respectful promo style. It's hard to describe. And I wish we had more of that. I don't think any Jose promos went up yet, but it's Geno that makes the match great. I mean, even though Lothario really does his stuff well, and Geno is just amazing in this. And I've never been that good at doing match reviews. And just so much of stuff. I mean, really good near... I guess, what do you call them, near falls in a Texas Death match? What do you call them?
Close calls?
Yeah, false... I guess false finishes. You can call them false finishes. You don't call them near falls. It's the same thing. So, might as well just call it a false finish. You know, Geno staggering up. The one thing I'm curious about is how this match relates psychology-wise to other Texas Death matches, because it feels almost like when Geno is getting beaten up and then barely answering the bell, it almost feels like it babyfaces him. But I'm wondering if that's just the way Texas Death matches worked, and these are fans of Texas who are used to Texas Death matches, so it's an established psychology at that point.
Very well could be the case. And, you know, they have reason to protect Geno, too. So.
Yes, but regardless, this makes me want to see more Texas Death matches in Texas, which we don't really have. Which sounds weird, but we don't. Think about it.
No, we don't. We don't.
I don't know if there are any other than this one.
Khan and Gordy.
Yes, okay. But that's it.
That may be it. That very well may be it.
I mean, we certainly don't have any, you know, the super famous ones, like from Amarillo or anything. which, no. You know, which are like what the most famous ones with Dory Funk Sr. going, you know, an hour and a half or whatever. But I really want to see, and I asked Bruce Farber, I was like, do you have more Texas Death Matches? And he said, yes, a lot. So I'm like, I'm really hoping he adds those soon. That,
and he very well may.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. So the next thing I watched, which I think was one of the suggested matches, and by the way, if you've subscribed, there are matches, or even if you haven't yet, for some reason there are a few matches that are available if you click through like the suggested thing at the end of a match, or I think it's there if you pause too, that aren't listed on the main July matches page yet, for whatever reason. But so next I watched Terry and Dory Funk against Jose Lothario and Mil Máscaras, which, especially after watching that list match, sounded amazing, and it wasn't. I don't know why. I don't know the best parts were when Terry was brawling with Lothario, which is not really surprising, but it wasn't much. I mean, the match went like half an hour, and it just wasn't that good. Makes me think that Mil Máscaras was never really any good in the U.S. Maybe he just saved it for Japan. Dory was Dory. And Jose, I almost feel like it's not a mark against him because I didn't expect him to do well in the slow technical wrestling stuff. So, honestly, this is skippable. Like, because it's not, you know, I'm someone that loves your 70s style Funk Brothers matches, you know, whether it's, you know, Funk Terry against Jumbo Tsuruta or even Dory against Inoki, which is 1969, but still basically a 70s style match. But this just didn't work for me. Yeah, I mean, it just this wasn't that good. I mean, which was sad because it was when I saw the list, that was one of the things I was most looking forward to. So then there was an interesting one, which was, so it's listed as Terry Funk versus Wahoo McDaniel. This was one of the matches people were most hyped up about. It turned out it was an actual Terry Funk versus Wahoo McDaniel match, but it's 3 minutes long. So this was part of a tournament for an NWA title shot. I forget if it's from 79 or 80, maybe even 81. And then the finals are immediately after, and it's Wahoo against Gino, which is much longer and another incredible match. Just blood, drama, brawling. Wahoo's chop being put over like death and looking like it should be a total finisher. Just more and more, I keep just watching this stuff and just realizing how amazing Gino is. So, yeah.
And I've heard.
And Wahoo. I mean, not that
I've heard some people say that is the best Wahoo match they've seen besides the Wahoo versus Nick Bockwinkel match from the AWA. Like, I've seen several people put that as like
really?
the top.
Wait, where are you reading that? Because I haven't seen that yet.
I've had a couple people tell me that privately, actually. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you what. This was the next thing I watched. So there was a new. So that was new. Then the next Wahoo Flair match, the one I watched, was new. There are two Wahoo Flair matches up. The one that's listed as the rematch is the one that was on the Monsters of the Mat Home video that was on the Death Valley Driver Mid-South set that lots of people have seen. What match that is a rematch of was new, had commentary from Bruce Tharp. Possibly the most non-formulaic great Ric Flair match I've ever seen. It is just totally what you'd want Wahoo versus Flair to be. Like, fast-paced, chopping the hell out of each other. Just really, really good. I mean, it's been a long time since I watched the other match, and I haven't rewatched it yet. But my gut says it might be that might even be the best Wahoo match I've ever seen. I'd say maybe it's even one of those two matches would be the best Wahoo match I've seen.
Excellent.
Although, you know what? I'm not sure if I've ever seen the Wahoo versus Magnum match. I for some reason. The famous one.
Either. Yeah, I don't know if I have either.
I'm trying to remember. What card was that from? Because I know it was on the... It was one of the Magnum tribute matches that they put on the Crockett Cup 87 tape, right?
Yes.
But it's from when he was... Wahoo was Tully's bodyguard, right?
Yes.
So it's from 84, but it's... was it made from Boogie Jam?
I think it was from Boogie Jam.
Okay.
But don't quote me on that, but I think it was from that show.
So I think that's the only place that match was available. And I've never seen that one, but I don't see how it would be less than very good. But it could be pretty heavily edited, too. So then what did I watch next? So the next thing I watched was Harley versus Andre, which is the match probably that Bruce Tharp was pushing the most and that the most people were looking forward to. And it's not like I expected it to be bad. I expected it to be at least very good, but it greatly, greatly exceeded my expectations. It is by far the best babyface Andre the Giant performance I've ever seen. because I mean, when you think about it, of the canonical in-ring Andre matches, which are babyface matches? Maybe the one with Hogan from Philly.
Yeah, that would probably be one. In Japan, he's really a heel or a tweener. You know, like the Hansen match.
Well, the Hansen match, he's the heel.
He is. You know, the Khan match, he's the heel from Japan, which is also a great match. Exceptionally underrated match, actually. He's pretty much the Kobayashi match from Japan.
He's a heel.
I think he's a heel, which is actually also 2 out of 3 falls.
And that's not, by the way, if you've never seen it, long match, great match, young, skinny Andre from 1972.
Totally different, yeah.
Doesn't he hit like a jumping tombstone pile driver?
Yeah. That's a great match. This you're probably right. I can't think of anything else. This has to be it.
Even late career, all the good stuff is him as a heel with wacky facial expressions and stuff, like the Randy Savage match or the, what is it, him and Rude against Duggan and Warrior?
Yeah, and or the time in like 85 or whatever where he carried Inoki kicking and screaming to a good match as Inoki was absolutely abysmal. Like, it would have to be this performance.
I mean, I've never seen the Otto Wands match, which is probably a bit too late, but I'm guessing he's a heel in that too. The one from 86.
Yeah, he's got to be. He's got to be a heel. Think about it.
Yeah, so other than that Hogan match in Philly where it's like Andre hits the referee on the top turnbuckle to get him out of the way and they just start beating the hell out of each other, I don't know another there's the Slaughter match, which is not great, but is really good. But I can't think of anything that's like this.
I mean, I haven't seen this race match yet, but every single person who's seen it's loved it. So that Slaughter match can't be at this level.
So,
you know what I mean?
This is Andre and Harley Race going 30-35 minutes doing a classic NWA world title match. And it's, I think as Phil mentioned, I don't think we have any other Andre NWA title matches.
Not to my knowledge, no.
And Andre's working. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily work in the mat, but really working holds well. And just great, like, finishes to the first and second falls. I guess Race body slammed him a few times, right? It's not just this match.
Yeah.
In this match, Race body slams him on the floor. And that's the end of the first fall. And it looks, sounds, is sold exactly like Andre being body slammed on the floor should be. Where it's like Andre can barely make it into the ring to answer the bell for the start of the second fall. But just everything, everything, you know, Race doing semi-comedy stuff. Like, he does the falling headbutt onto Andre, hits him in the head, and then sells it as if he, you know, headbutted, like, you know, The Rock or whatever. But that's not me being racist. That's me making fun of racism in wrestling. So nobody start anything. Where was I? Yeah, just it is a great match. I mean, it's probably one of my very favorite Harley Race matches too. I mean, there is, at least as far as title matches, it would be, I mean, not that we have a lot of Harley Race, like 70s NWA title matches, but it's
77 match with Lawler, which I love.
77 match with Lawler, which goes an hour, the Jumbo match from 70, is that 76 or 77, or is that even 78?
I don't remember.
You know the one I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
The one with the Indian Deathlock.
Yep, yep.
Those, I think, would be my favorite. I don't know. Would you? Is there anything else you'd want to throw in?
Those are the ones that come to mind off the top of my head.
I mean, there's other. Well, you know what? I mean, later on, when he's less the iconic champion, the Flair match that sets up Starrcade is excellent.
Yes.
And really better than the Starrcade match. I mean, he has good matches later, too. You know, even as late as, like, 1990. But. Well, actually, you know what? I don't think I've watched it, but I think there's a handheld online now of the 93 Flair match.
Really?
I think it exists. It might not be online, but I think it does exist.
I may have to do some investigative reporting later tonight and see if I can uncover that, because that's something I'd really like to see. But
as far as Andre, yeah, but this is just really good. I mean, it's, and really, again, because it's babyface Andre. I mean, you've never seen Andre like this before. And also, one thing I loved. So I think sometimes I'll use it as an example of just selling and also guys like able to minimize their size. Like, you know, like was it Tom or Phil that always used to talk about that with Dustin Rhodes?
I believe it was Tom, but that sounds like something Phil would say, too.
I think they both did. And that, like, Dustin Rhodes is a legit 6'6 guy who worked underdog babyface for the first several years of his career. And it's really what he's best at doing. And he did it well. And then there's this match I always talk about. It's DiBiase against Big Boss Man from the Garden. I think, like, 1990? Right, because that's when their feud was, right?
Yeah.
Big Boss Man turned, and yeah. Really, really good match. And there's one spot, and I remember this from the first time I saw it live as a kid. DiBiase puts him in a bear hug. And it works. You wouldn't think it would, but it works. Which, to be fair, I mean, Boss Man is thicker, but DiBiase is much bigger than people realize.
Yes.
But it works, and it works better than you'd ever expect, and it's a really good. I actually haven't watched it in a long time, but I remember that being a really good match. I don't know when do you know the match I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen it. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I've seen.
But
it.
It's a really good match, right? You remember the spot and everything.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite DiBiase matches in the company.
Yes. Yeah, I don't even know what I'd put above that. And there's the Dustin Rhodes match, maybe. I'm trying to think if there's
anything. Yeah, Dustin Rhodes 10-minute challenge might be the only match I put above it. I don't like the Savage matches nearly as much as some people do.
Yeah, I mean, I like them, but yeah, not that much.
And anyway, I don't want to get bogged down in that because we're already.
But the point is, Harley Race Bear hugs Andre. And
yes, it's effective.
And it works.
All right. We've already done like 45 minutes roughly on NWA Classics, which
Jesus,
I'm not supposed
to. We have already. I mean, is there anything else I want to – let me just think for a second. Is there anything?
I do want to mention there's like other stuff that I know. Like there's a Buddy Landell, Butch Reed, Chew Shine match I think that maybe has never before been seen. That's one of the ones that I think I've seen people talk around.
There's Buddy Landell and Masao Ito against – who is it? Oh, against Rock and Roll Express, which I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, there's I've heard people
Dusty Rhodes. I do want to put over Dusty Rhodes versus Mark Lewin.
Dusty Rhodes and Mark Lewin. That's the other one I wanted you to talk about, sure.
Oh my god. As I said on Twitter, this was basically hepatitis the match. they are bleeding quickly. And this was for the Brass Knucks title, which was basically the early equivalent of the hardcore title, but without the bullshit.
Yes, that's a good one. And another Texas staple, by the way. Yes. You see that a lot of Texas.
That was a Texas wrestling thing. I mean, I think it went to some other territories, but it was a Texas thing. And they're just wild brawl, going through tables, brawling into the crowd, into the aisle. 2x4 gets used, and they're just brawling. And this ends quickly, not as quickly as Funk Wahoo, but like 6 minutes. But the finish is perfect. They get just kind of like tanked. They're on the apron hitting each other. I think they get kind of tangled up in the ropes for a second. And Dusty bionic elbows him right, as Phil put it, right in the brainstem, like right in the nape of the neck and the back of the head. And Lewin's knocked silly. He drops an elbow on him, and that's the match. And Dusty wins the Brass Knuckles title.
And what's cool about that is Mark Lewin is somebody that we don't have a lot of footage of.
And this is the most fun Mark Lewin match I've ever seen.
Yeah, so it's just cool to be able to get something from his career, especially because, as you've argued in the past, Mr. Kaleidoscope, and I am pretty much in agreement with you. He's like he's probably Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame level guy. So it's always cool when we can get little glimpses of some of these guys that fell through the footage cracks for whatever reason. So that's a nice touch, and that's a nice touch for this service as a whole. You know,
and Mark Lewin's a guy who's probably going to benefit from that too, a lot.
Yeah,
probably
yeah,
maybe I more guess. Than a lot of people because he was a Texas staple. You know, and this is closer to his prime than most of the stuff we have.
Yes. All
Why
right.
Don't we just quickly go through some of the other matches that are on here? That
sure.
Some of the stuff that looks interesting or whatever.
Sure. Go ahead.
Or why don't you pull up the list, too, so you can look at it with me. So as I think I – did I mention – was this before we started that I mentioned Hector Guerrero versus Dr. Death, or was that after we started?
That was – we were already on the air.
Okay. So, yeah, it looks like they've added that since the other stuff. Fritz – I think it's Fritz, Kevin, and Carrie is the six-man match that's up. against Gary Hart, Dick Murdoch, and the White Knight, who I don't know who it is, but that's a two right now.
That could be Pat Rose. He used that gimmick in Puerto Rico. So.
Okay. Oh, was he? Did he also use that gimmick in Florida, maybe?
He very well could have.
Okay, so, yeah, and that is a two-ring – they have a couple of these up. A two-ring six-man tag match where there are guys paired off in each ring and a guy in the middle who can tag into either ring, which is a very cool gimmick, and I haven't watched any of these yet. Vicky Williams and Leilani Kai actually sounds interesting from 1979 because Kai is really underrated. I don't know if I've ever seen any Vicky Williams, but seeing Kai wrestling anyone who's – you know, wrestling basically not Moolah – or anyone like that.
Just someone competent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about Vicky Williams, but I remember her being not a bad worker from what I know. So that's kind of interesting. Terry Taylor, Steve Williams. That could be really good. It depends on when it's from. Because Doc doesn't necessarily get really good until like 85. DiBiase versus Bob Sweetan. I don't know if that's the match we've seen or not. But I'm probably going to watch it either way because I love the match we have, which is the tape fist match. We mentioned Superstar Graham versus Tiger Conway Jr. Why is this not giving me the link to the additional pages? Let's see. Unless my Skype recorder is over it. No, it's not. Okay, that's weird. You know what? Oh, wait. Maybe I'll just click matches now instead of clicking July 2015. And there we go. Okay. No, that didn't work. Oh, no, there we go. Next page. I don't think that was there before. So, yes, let's see. Superstar Billy Graham, I mean, never a great worker, but I think it's always fun to see him outside the WWF.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Sonny King versus Masao Ito. Ito, not a great worker, but kind of interesting, and always want to see more Sonny King. Rock and Roll Express and Jose Lothario versus the Guerreros and Buddy Landell. Not a new match, but something we talked about on the podcast, Buddy Landell podcast with Chris.
Yep.
So people can check that out now. Rock and Rolls and Duggan against DiBiase, Doc, and Hercules, I believe, is a new match. Rock and Roll against Landell and Ito, we mentioned. Flair and Terry Taylor, I think, is the one we've all seen. I haven't checked yet. I don't get why they're putting some of these prelim matches up. Like, why do you put up Mark Reagan against Pat Rose?
I don't know, but I love Pat Rose, so I don't care. Yeah.
And Mark Reagan was not bad.
Yeah, I honestly don't care because I love Pat Rose. But,
Magnum TA and Butch Reed, Crusher Khrushchev and Jay Youngblood. We don't have a lot of Jay Youngblood. All this might is probably after he started having his issues. If he's Crusher Khrushchev, then yeah, this is probably 84-ish, right?
Yes.
Kevin Von Erich versus Chris Adams in a match that it has been around, was on the DVD VR set, but is this short, awesome match that everyone should watch. Kerry Von Erich versus Gino, I think, was around. I'm going to skip over some of these. Wait. There was labeled Texas Death Match. It's the Gino Lothario match. Again, skipping over some of the stuff that's already around, like some of the other mid-80s stuff. Jake and Nord the Barbarian against Mark Reagan and Brickhouse Brown. That's intriguing.
That is bizarre. That's the kind of grab bag match I was referring to.
And here's another one. Jake the Snake Roberts against Private Terry Daniels, which could actually be really good.
Yes, it could.
Iceman King Parsons against Dale Veazey, who I forgot was around back then.
Oh, I love Dale Veazey.
A new Jim Duggan Ted DiBiase match. Gino, Grand Marcus, and Killer Brooks against Lothario, El Halcón, and Mil Máscaras.
Which has been around, but it is...
It was around with the stuff like the Texas Death Match.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've seen that one, though.
Pete from Titans of Wrestling actually just watched that, I think, today and reviewed it and gave it 4 stars. So that's Halcón, one of his favorite things to
watch. We've never seen enough Halcón from Texas. Or in general, but Halcón always had the rep of being one of the best luchadors as far as working with American guys. And Tim Brooks has, at least per Gary Hart, was very good at working with luchadors. Although I haven't seen it, but I trust it. Gino Hernandez against Bob Marcus. Gino Hernandez against Ivan Putski, which Pete F3 really liked. We watched the Ox Baker match, right? He didn't watch this one yet. A Gino interview. Eddie Gilbert and Jerry Gray against the Fantastics, which Jerry Gray was serviceable. I mean,
I like Jerry Gray in Portland.
But it's Eddie Gilbert against the Fantastics, so.
Sure.
Duggan, Dog, and Tito Santana against Butch Reed, Volkoff, and Khrushchev.
Which is an elimination match, I believe.
Yes. Murdoch, Al Perez, Murdoch, Nightmare, which I really... Oh, this I wanted to ask you. the Murdoch Nightmare match on the Death Valley Driver set, is that from Houston?
I don't know.
Because I thought it was the title change. This is not the title change.
I actually don't know the answer to that.
Butch Reed and Kamala. Butch Reed and Dutch Mantel. Buddy Landell, Butch Reed in the Shoeshine match. I just want to go through these just so people get the idea, because I want people to subscribe. Brad Armstrong versus One Man Gang, which could be awesome.
Which is from 85, yeah.
Two-ring battle royal. This is a perfect grab bag match. Dr. Death Steve. Oh, yeah. How much of these matches have you looked at the list?
I've skimmed it here and there.
Okay. Actually, two matches from this guy. So we've got Barry Orton matches against both Dr. Death Steve Williams and Lanny Poffo. Barry Orton's a really underrated worker.
I like Barry Orton. Barry Orton and Lanny Poffo could be really awesome, actually.
Norton Barbarian match against Shawn Michaels, which they had been hyping a bit because, I would if they were that, I were them. Guerrero's against DiBiase and Doc in a Bandolero death match, which is a new match, and that's an awesome feud. Different match than I had thought it was. Andre the Giant against Tank Patton. An Andre interview. That's it. I thought there were a few more. You know what? I think there were a few interviews that are just listed under interviews. Maybe that's why. Yeah. There's some Wahoo interviews, a Tully interview, Conway interview, Casey, Gino, Danny McShane, Chavo, and I think another Andre interview. Did I say Andre twice? I don't know. So yeah, NWA Classics, subscribe. You'll like it. Even if you're... there's some really, really amazing stuff up. I mean, and that's mostly for me talking about the stuff that I've seen that was new, as opposed to the great stuff that we've seen before that's up there. I mean,
which a lot of people haven't seen.
Which a lot of people haven't seen anyway. Yeah.
I mean, and in no way am I saying that to sound like we're hot shit or anything. It's just if you're somebody who wasn't a part of the tape trading circles or came along a little bit later, or maybe you were around then, but you weren't as insane as me or Bix. you might not have seen any of this or very, very little of this. So for a lot of people, this is all new. I mean, it's only for really the hardest of the hardcore that any of this, sans a handful of matches, is old. And even for those of us who have been collectors and tape traders for decades, which I can actually say in all honesty, which is disturbing.
Which is also disturbing. I started 17 resource. Years ago. That's close enough to decades.
Yeah. I mean, this is a great resource. So I haven't subscribed yet, in all honesty, but my plan is to do it on Friday, as soon as my paycheck gets deposited, because I'm watching
my pay window.
I'm watching my budget. Yeah, I've got to quote Steve Austin, I've got those gimmicks called bills. So I've got to pay those first, but after I take care of that, I will be moving on to NWA Classics.
By the way, one of the weird things I wanted to mention before we move on, Houston Wrestling, oddly one of the better exposed territories, not territories, but you know what I mean, in terms of home video footage availability in the 80s.
Yes. Monsters of the Mat, all that stuff.
You had Monsters of the Mat, you had the USA All-Star Wrestling, and you had the Congress Video Group Superstar/All-Star Wrestling, which, boy, those were weird. So you had the first half, which were 1983 Crockett TV squashes, and they would list the affiliate. They would say, like the box would say, we have the best promotions for best matches for regardless of promotional affiliation. And even though they were all from Crockett TV, and never mind that they're not the best matches, they would say some of the matches would be listed as NWA, and some would be listed as non, as if there was no promotional affiliation, even though they were all from Crockett. But then the second half, which is also much harder to find, like it was easy to find the Crockett ones in stores like FYE and until, God, early 2000s?
Yeah.
I mean, relatively easy, especially the featuring Bob Orton and featuring Wahoo McDaniel volumes. It always seemed to be the easiest to find. Or did you have the same experience?
Yes, yeah, even down here.
Yeah, so... those are the much better tapes, but they're also much harder to find, and as such commanded more money. And those have a lot of great matches. I mean, those have stuff that, like, it's weird. A lot of those matches were not around via we only have really one good source for Houston TV, but it's all from that period. And a lot of that stuff was not, maybe it didn't air. I don't know.
It may not have.
The tape fist match is from a period where we have actually wait no I don't think it was in because I don't want to say his name just for obvious reasons even though he's a lovely human being. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I don't think the tape fist match with DiBiase and Sweetan was on his tapes, right?
I don't think so either.
And he has all the TV from that period. Or if not all, then most. Yeah, I don't know, but it helped. That stuff all has commentary, so I don't know. I just wanted to mention that, though. It's one of the reasons, though, why people wanted the Houston stuff out, because they knew that they saved a lot. Because clearly they saved a lot, because they did the classic show, they did the, and the, whatchamacallit, the USA All-Star Wrestling stuff was interesting, because it was late 70s stuff, too.
Yeah, which is not, you know, the late 70s are not an, a treasure trove of things that we have availability of.
Though the match selection on those was not great, at least in terms of match mm-hmm. quality. There's some good, big stars, but for whatever reason, it's like, you know, Dusty versus Ivan Koloff in a casket match is interesting, but not great, to my recollection. But there are a couple volumes of that stuff. And actually, wait, there's a Ken Patera match on one of those, right?
Oh God, I don't remember. It's been so long since I've looked at any of that stuff. Like there are people who could reel off the top of your, you being one of them, but other people too, who can reel off the top of their head like any of these commercial releases, what's on them. I am terrible about that. Absolutely awful.
But when I say, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
This was one of those things. Like I think I mentioned on the last show when we had Kevin on. About how, like, you know, the whole picking of, you know, judging a video store by its wrestling selection thing.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, it was, but it was, like, that was the type of thing, like, it was, you know, when I would visit my grandparents, like, that would help, like, expose me to things. Like, so for, like, years, too, like, one of the lesser-known territorial wrestler I knew was Don Diamond. Because of those tapes. Because he's in, like, the one sort of angle that's on those tapes, because it's, like, I think it's Brody against one of the Twin Devils, and they do the switch. And then Don Diamond runs out and puts powder in their hair.
That's like when I was a kid, I thought Timothy Flowers was a big deal because of New Wave Wrestling. The magazine, not the tape, but yeah.
So it's not one of our podcasts to not go long about this, but whatever. It's fun. So what do we want to talk about next? Right now I remember.
We're going to close with the big dog, which is our everybody's favorite thermos penis Hulk Hogan.
Who was it that made the thermos reference? I'm trying to remember. Was it Howard Stern? Because I remember he.
It might have been in the original Gawker article. I can't remember. It's just,
God! Didn't they refer to it like ruining their memories of the Hulk Hogan lunchbox or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes, yes. We'll get to that when we cover. But in the end,
which I believe I did have.
Which Hulk Hogan's penis?
No, the actual lunchbox and thermos.
Well, we'll talk about Bix's experiences with Hulk Hogan's penis later in the show. But before we get to that, I wanted to cover, and I'm going to cover this kind of under the rubric of
business models,
because this is a little bit, you know, partially I have a bias here because as people who follow me on Twitter at Dylan Winko are familiar with some of the things that I've been doing recently for VoicesOfWrestling.com, know I am a huge fan of Southern independent wrestling. I think it is really underexposed. A lot of these promotions run weekly or biweekly. They probably draw more a year than places like Evolve do, for example, but they're almost never
covered.
Nothing
against Evolve, but I'm surprised you said probably.
Well, I mean, you know, I some of them don't because I'm speaking more generally. I mean, like a promotion like, say, Empire, you know, today I released a long interview with Empire's booker Andrew Alexander on VoicesWrestling.com. And a promotion like Empire absolutely draws more fans a year than Evolve.
But would it really surprise you that in any given year, like USWO doesn't run anymore, do they?
No, they do not.
Okay, but would it surprise you if in any given year that USWO sold more paid tickets than Evolve did in any given year?
Of course they did. I mean, I don't think...
Well, they were weekly, too, but...
That's kind of my point, though, is these promotions are promotions that have a different business model. Like, in the... I'll go ahead and just mention this now. In the interview I do with Andrew Alexander that, again, is available at voiceswrestling.com, you know, I talk about the very specific business model that Empire does, which they have a biweekly model. They run shows every 2 weeks.
Like Houston Wrestling.
And then once a month they do an all women show, which is also interesting for the South because you don't really expect that of a Southern wrestling promotion, frankly. And that is not part of that. So that's a third show on some week, sometimes within the 2 week window.
That's their Tuesday special.
And yes, and they also occasionally will use their venue for other promotions that want to run there, like DSCW or whatever. So sometimes there are some months where there's four or five shows in that venue in a month. But their motto is basically they do these shows every 2 weeks, and they build an episodic show. Now, they don't really have a TV. They don't really have a YouTube channel. I mean, they do have a YouTube channel, but it's not updated a whole lot. But what they do is they build to quarterly big shows. And those quarterly big shows always do good business. Like, I don't think they've had a single one that didn't, have several hundred people in this venue. And they're some of the biggest shows that are in independent wrestling in Georgia all year. And it is a model that works well for them. They are not well known because they don't really distribute their content. They have one DVD that I think maybe two DVDs they put out that they only sell to gimmick tables at their shows. And they put up some stuff on their website, and you can go to the TV section and view some of the whole supercards there after a couple months. Usually they'll throw them up there. But generally speaking, they don't have a distribution platform. And what's interesting is, there now looks like and I don't know whether this party will be working with Empire specifically, other than to say that he retweets a lot of the stuff that I write about Empire, so that could be the case. But there is now a actor on the scene that may be interested in distributing at least some of these shows. And to be fair, you do have something like Anarchy, which has weekly TV that's out every single week. You can find it on YouTube very easily, and there are, Saw still, up in the Nashville area. There are other places, but this is, among the upstart groups, there's not a whole lot of it. So this is kind of an interesting thing because Woo Wrestling, that's WHOO exclamation point, I believe, wrestling, has tested out a new sort of idea, and it's not that they're not the first person to
do Woo Wrestling, though, because people aren't aware that Woo Wrestling was an existing thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Bix. I'll actually let you do that.
Yeah, I mean, you can try a little. So Woo, was a site that even if you weren't into indie wrestling, people knew back in somewhere we think 97, 90 to 99, probably about.
That's about right.
So it was run by Alan Berry, who's the guy who's behind it all now again, who people would probably best know, though, as manager Al Getz in Wildside and elsewhere. And it was a site for indie news, and he did distribute some videos through there, too. And I don't know when they just completely stopped being a thing, but it's been a very long time.
Yes. Yeah, it's been years since I even thought about that site. But what they've done is
they have the Woo Top 50 or something like that.
I believe they did. I think they did have something like that on the site. But what they've done is they have got a Vimeo page where they have put up a Jimmy Ray of AJ Styles match from Pro South Wrestling, a show that I actually went to. I traveled to. In Piedmont, Alabama, which is in the middle of nowhere. And I don't mean that to disparage Piedmont, Alabama. It's just in the middle of nowhere. I tweeted about it at the time. It was a great match, absolutely sold out. They did turn away people, or so I was told. I mean, and it's AJ Styles and Jimmy Rave going 25 minutes in a 90-degree gym, and they had no reason to have a great match, and they did. And at the time, I thought, man, they're crazy to have worked that hard. But now, perhaps the reason they were working that hard is because it was planned to be released on video. And I'm not knocking those guys because Jimmy Rave, especially, AJ is maybe the best in the world. Jimmy Rave is a guy that I think works hard every single time I see him these days. So, but this match is now available for download through Vimeo.
So let's talk about this.
Let's talk about the particulars of that, and I'll let you talk. I watched it and you haven't yet, so I'll let you talk about the
actual planning on it. I just haven't yet. Yeah,
I'll let you talk about the price point and things of that nature, and then I will talk about the actual content of the video.
Okay, so you can get it on Vimeo. There are two ways to watch it. You can either rent it for is it 48 or 72 hours?
It's 72 hours.
Okay,
it's
72 hours for $3, or you can buy it, which is includes either – the rental is just streaming on the Vimeo page. If you buy it for $6, you get also get an MP4 download. And if you use the coupon styles – it styles 15, right?
Correct. A styles in all caps.
Yeah, styles 15. Then you get a dollar off either of them. So if you're renting it, it's $2. If you're buying it, it's $5, really. And I really like that they're doing this. I feel like sticker price probably should have been $5 or less, because I feel like if people are going to buy a single match, they're more likely to do it that way. But I, you know, it's fine. I mean, I wouldn't fault them too much.
No, especially with the coupon code. And
I do want to add, as someone who hasn't seen it yet, the trailer is awesome and makes me want to see the match more.
Yes. And, you know, I agree with you in theory that maybe you could drop the to-own price $1, you know. But I'm not bothered by it, especially after seeing it, because – here's the thing about this. Like, you know, Black Terry Jr. does the handhelds of shows down in Mexico. Obscure matches that we would never ever see ever if it wasn't for him. And I think he charges $4 a pop. Okay. So,
I knew he did this, but I didn't really know much about dealing with it. Like, so how do you buy matches from Black Terry Jr. anyway?
Presumably you go through them on YouTube.
Okay.
You know, but. The point is there is an existing sort of idea like this. It's not like this.
And there's
the first
Click Wrestle, which is not usually recent matches, but it's cheaper, which is usually 99 cents each. Although I want to say back in their heyday, it was more like $2 at the cheapest.
Yes. And also you can contact Black Terry Jr. on Twitter. I should mention that. Okay. But so there are things that have happened like this. But what is interesting about this to me is actually, I'd say, three things that I think make it a little bit distinct. The first thing that makes it a little bit distinct is that it is a Southern indie wrestling show, and that if you follow Wu on Twitter, which everybody should, if you look at what I think the goal is to expose people to more Southern wrestling. So the goal is not necessarily to go travel around the country and record all these dream matches. The goal, I think, is to sort of open up this new, to many people anyway, Southern indie scene, so that we maybe be able to see some of this stuff that has been previously unavailable. So that's one thing that's a little bit different.
That said, though, I mean, I really do love the idea of someone really trying to push the a la carte thing again with it.
Yes, and well, that's the second. You know, thing is that it is an a la carte model, which are, or at least the first matches, I shouldn't say, because I don't know what the future plans are going to be. But the other thing that I think makes this kind of distinct, there's actually two other things, is and they're both in the presentation. The video itself is not just a match, okay? It is, they do a good job sort of setting the table. Like, they show you the venue itself, the line outside the venue before the show. They do fan interviews, like, to kind of hype things up. They have an extended replay after the match. They show the AJ Styles promo after the match.
And some of the fan stuff is in the trailer, by the way.
Correct. So you get it. It's more of a professional package rather than just buying, like, and you buy something and ding, 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 the bell rings, and then the pinfall is over and that's it. There's a little bit more that you're getting that I think adds to the atmosphere. It almost – I don't want to say it makes you feel like you're there, because I actually was there, so I don't know that I can make that as a fair comparison. But it does add – I think it adds a little bit of value. You know, does it add 20 cents of value, $1, $2? I don't know. That depends on the person. But I think it adds a little bit to the presentation. The third thing – and I hope this continues to be the case, because I think these guys were a great announce team, is Al Getz does the announcing with Dan Wilson, who I believe is the best commentator in wrestling today. And Al Getz is really good, but I think Dan Wilson is the best commentator in wrestling today. Dan Wilson also does the commentary for the aforementioned Empire shows, and he was most famously the commentator for Wildside. Okay. So, I mean, and I think he is an excellent guy. Like, if you're somebody who hates modern pro wrestling commentary and you're like, God, it's all awful, to me, it's almost worth spending a couple bucks just to rent this, just to hear the commentary that Dan and Al do, because it makes you realize it is still possible to actually have good, relevant commentary on a pro wrestling match. Again, that's something that is an added value that you're not going to get anywhere else, because frankly, there's no commentary team I've heard this year that I think has been as good as them. And that's not blowing smoke. That's honestly how I feel. I know Chris Zellner said the same thing. There's other people that have said the same thing. I don't want to oversell it and, you know, people think that they're going to hear like something that's going to blow their mind, but it's rock solid pro wrestling commentary the way that pro wrestling commentary should be done. And it really enhances the match too, I think. So it is a really cool model. And we know from things that the Woo Twitter account has retweeted this week or tweeted out this week, we know that they've got other projects going on. This is not going to be like a one and done type thing. They've got, I don't know if they're going to be individual matches. I don't know if they're going to be whole cards. I don't know if they're going to be, you know, documentary. I have no clue what the plans are, other than that they definitely are planning to do more things. So that to me is really exciting. And I think it's something that more promotions should think about doing, or more people should think about doing. You know, it doesn't have to be a single promotion. You know, it could be I don't think this will be a single promotion. I think it's going to be bouncing around maybe from place to place, you know, because I know Al Getz has been working as a manager, I think, on the Luke Gallows shows that have been promoted out of Barnesville, out of Chris Zellner's hometown. So, you know, I hopefully. We're going to see a variety of things come out from Woo Wrestling in coming months. And hopefully that'll, you know, other people are going to follow suit.
Yeah. So there were a couple other things I want to talk about quickly before we talk about Hogan, which...
Sure.
So one of them, I mean, just briefly, the Beast in the East special on WWE Network. So is it just me, or was this really the first time since some of the stuff at the beginning that it felt like, oh, this is what WWE Network should be, this type of thing?
Full disclosure, and if anybody wants to hear my full comments on this, they can go to the PWOPTVN Podcasting Network and listen to the reaction show we did on this. I do think, in theory, that this is exactly the sort of thing they should be doing, but I also didn't think this was a great show. Mm. I think this is one of those things where the biggest benefit, I think they have kind of been doing this with the NXT specials. What they need is these 2-hour shows. That's what they need. They need 2-hour windows that they can. I think that almost is more important than anything, because I think people are more lenient with the 2-hour shows. I don't want to say that everybody is overrating this and blah blah, because people have different aesthetic tastes, whatever. But I think being 2 hours, it is much easier to feel like when it's over, you know what, that was pretty good, that was enjoyable, even if there was stuff on the show that you didn't like or that underperformed or disappointed. So to me, they need to be doing these 2-hour block shows, even if it's maybe one a month for starters, and maybe they could do more going forward. But something a little bit different that is an easier to consume product. And, you know, I mean, for example, what's to stop them from doing another show like this in another month and maybe having a tag title switch, you know, like,
right. But really, what I was thinking though was just really an international tour house show that had something interesting on it. That's just, it's like, okay, we have an outlet for that. Why not? It's like, they should be doing, like, I feel like when you have a network like this, why not should be something that goes through your head all the time.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I think they've got, they were able to pair with J-Sport here, and which probably, I don't want to say it eased the cost. I don't know that.
It probably made it a lot more likely for them to do it here. I mean, they haven't done a Japanese special since like 2002, 2003?
Long time. Yeah, it's over a decade. I think that they will do more things like this,
Having said that, I feel like they've got to be really careful because it's not just that. If you're a fan like us, okay, like the people on this Skype line recording this podcast right now, mm-hmm. or like the people who are going to be listening to this for the most part, you knew what you were going to get going into this. Basically, you're probably going to get a title switch for the NXT title. And you were going to get a Brock squash over Kofi Kingston, which a lot of people didn't. The average fan probably didn't know he was fighting Kofi, you know. But you knew you were going. You basically had an idea, and you were going to get the Jericho special appearance match. So you kind of knew what you were going to get. But if you're a fan like just a more casual fan, like some of the people I work with, who I discussed the special with today, and you stayed up till 5:30 a.m. to watch this show live. Or you woke up early to watch this show live and you see a 2-minute Brock Lesnar match versus Kofi Kingston, your response is fuck you. You know, I know people say, well, what did you expect? Well, it's easy for us to say that. We're the people who read The Observer. We're the people who how does this play to the average fan when you title your special Beast in the East and Brock's on TV for 2 minutes?
They should have had a storyline reason and said outright that he was facing Kofi Kingston, yes.
I just feel like that's stuff you have to be careful with, because that's the kind of stuff that – and I saw this firsthand today with more casual fans. I have a couple guys at work that they didn't stay up all night, but they woke up early to watch the show live, and they were pissed. You know, and that was even after I told them that Brock that was going to be wrestling Kofi. You know, one of the guys insisted that it couldn't be true. But, like, they just – they were still pissed off. You know, because to them, they, you know, at the very least, they wanted an angle, even if it was a 2-minute match, or, you know, and that's an unrealistic expectation because, as most people have pointed out, this is basically just a live televised house show. But you don't want people to think they're getting added value and then feel cheated, because that is how you lose subscribers. And I'm not saying anybody's going to unsubscribe over this, but you've got to be very careful about how you brand these shows, is what I'm getting at. Because, you know, while my experience may not be an experience that's shared by a ton of people, I find it hard to believe that the two guys I know are the only people on the planet who didn't come away from that feeling ripped off. So I would be a little bit careful about how they brand some of this stuff going forward. Having said that, they absolutely should be doing stuff like this.
Yes. Other thing I really just wanted to mention for a second, actually different, I think, from what I said before the show. Just quick note that I thought was cool. New Japan World added a bunch of old Osaka Castle Hall matches in advance of Dominion because it was the first show in, what, 20 years at Osaka
Castle Hall? Something like that.
And one of them was a Holy Grail match, which was the uncut version of, I believe, the September 89 Jushin Liger versus Naoki Sano match.
Yes.
Which... all of the Liger Sano matches had showed up complete except for that one. I think people had looked into if it was on a Samurai TV like New Japan Classics that people had missed recording, and I think it turned out it hadn't. And there it was. I watched like the first match and a half of Dominion and then fell asleep. But I saw that like the next morning. I was like, huh, is that that match? And yeah, it is. So
for people who don't know too, because not everybody who listens may be familiar, Liger Sano is arguably the best junior heavyweight feud in the history of pro wrestling. At least that we have documentation of visually.
Yes.
On tape. So
it is completely unlike just about all the other Jushin Liger feuds in New Japan. I mean, it is violent and hateful and really the only other one like that in Liger's prime would be. Well, two. I mean, to some degree, El Samurai and Norio Hanaga.
Yeah, the Hanaga series I think is similar too. But I mean, so this is much. If you're a fan of Japanese wrestling, if you're a fan of the junior, I would regard this as much the. And I'm probably going to go watch it tonight when we're done recording this.
And actually, and people don't realize because he just moved around a lot and changed his name and all sorts of stuff. Norio Hanaga, not Norio. Well, Norio Hanaga is great too, but Naoki Sano is an all-time great wrestler.
Sano is a tremendous wrestler, absolutely great wrestler. But one other thing, real quick, that I want to mention, because I didn't get this in when we were talking about Southern Indies, I'm going to slip it in.
Oh yes, the Scenic City Invitational.
The Scenic City Invitational. I've been a shameless tweeter of this. But I do want to mention this because, you know, it will be at the Empire Arena, from Roswell, Georgia, although it is sort of an Empire show in the sense that it's from the arena. Empire is sort of the supporting promotion behind it. But, Scott Hensley is the actual promoter. He's sort of doing, I think, booking it even on his own. This is another thing that I think is kind of a cool outside the box concept that's being done by a Southern independent. I do know for a fact that we'll be taped. Scott said so himself. I don't know what the distribution model for it will be, but I assume there's going to be some sort of distribution model in place for this. It is shaping up to be actually a pretty awesome tournament. For those people who aren't familiar with it, you can go to their Facebook page. Just type in Scenic City Invitational, will come up. And what they've been doing is they've been releasing entrants at a staggered rate based on likes to the page, and they've been releasing this week they've been releasing first round matches basically every day, actually. So we've got four first round matches so far, and I'll just cover those really quickly, which is we've got Gunnar Miller versus Chip Day. For those who don't know, Gunnar Miller was a University of Tennessee Chattanooga football player. Actually, WWE was in talks with him for a while. He's got a tremendous look. I can't imagine he won't end up in that system eventually. He's super athletic. He is green, but I've seen the guy live, and he has a lot of charisma. Probably one of the most over guys in that area. Chip Day, I think, is one of the best heels in Southern independent wrestling. Almost the ideal opponent for Gunnar Miller because he's a ring general. Then we've got today the announced match was Jimmy Rave versus Anthony Henry, which to me looks like the best match that possible on paper out of the first round. Anthony Henry is a guy, another guy with a great look that I almost can't believe hasn't been signed just because of his look alone. Who's a very good worker. Jimmy Rave, who I think is having a tremendous year. I think Jimmy Rave is one of the 10 best guys in the world this year so far, if not better. And he's been good every time out.
But
so
the ROH fans 10 years ago think he's a terrible.
Well, the ROH fans forget that he had great matches with a ton of people there, including Nigel and Danielson and Punk and everybody else. But and Styles. But that – so that's –
By the way, I'm talking about 10 years ago, ROH fans from 10 years ago. I'm not talking about current ROH fans.
Correct.
10 years ago. It was a joke. But it was a joke.
There's Corey Hollis versus Joey Lynch. Joey Lynch is a local guy who I think actually has potential to kind of make his name in this tournament, especially if it's distributed widely, because he's got a look that is he kind of seems like he would fit in with the Ring of Honor type stuff. And he is a guy who has stepped up to the plate. He's had some big matches on the big Empire shows that are available on the Empire website on their YouTube channel that you can check out. Corey Hollis, I think, is actually known to a lot of people. He's worked underneath on a lot of Ring of Honor shows and other kind of name indie shows. He's a really good worker, one of the better in-ring guys in the Southeast. And then the other match is kind of a dream match. And this is what I think distinguishes this tournament a little bit from some of these other tournaments, because some of the guys that we don't have announced matches so far are people like Gunner of TNA fame.
Two
Moose.
Gunners in the tournament then.
That's right. Moose from Ring of Honor is in the tournament. We don't have a match from him yet.
We have two Gunners in a tournament. It's like a 90s indie tournament with Shane or Brad.
But we have this match, Kongo Kong versus Tank, which is like an IWA Mid-South dream match taking place in Roswell, Georgia. So it is like – and what I like about it is this isn't all indie work rate guys. I mean, there are a lot of guys like that, and a lot of guys who I really like that work that style are in this tournament. But this is a match between two big dudes, and I think that sort of sets this apart from a lot of the other tournaments like Bola.
What's probably closest to then? The JT Lightning tournament.
Yeah, I think it is. It has a different feel. You're not just getting one style of guy. You're not getting so And I think the model that Scott has used in promoting this so far, I think, has been pretty interesting. There's a lot of hype surrounding it. This does not necessarily fit under the purview of this show, but I did want to plug it.
It's an indie business model. Why not?
I did want to plug it shamelessly because I've been very supportive of it, and I am making the trip up there. I know, and actually, a lot of people who listen to this, I think, are actually going to try and make the trip. So, that's coming up on August 7th and August 8th. And it is a unique model, and it's something different that a Southern, to my knowledge, no Southern independent promotion of any size has tried anything quite like this before, because it's a mix of big guys and little guys. It's a mix of relatively big names and names that are relatively unknown outside of that area. And I honestly have no clue how it's going to be booked, which I think also makes it exciting. There's you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and if we're counting Florida as the South, which I think we should, the only tournaments I can think of would be the Peterson Cups.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually a fair comparison, even though I don't think Florida counts as the South. But anyway,
so I think I want you to lead on this, even though it's my thing, because you lead and kind of push me in the directions you want to go with this, because, you know, I did my article in Figure Four last week, but... So, you know, there's lots of stuff to talk about, though, and I figure I don't want to just rehash what I did or go off in different directions. So you kind of lead me on what you want to know and what you want to talk about.
Okay, here's...
Well, there are a few things, though. I mean, and there is a direct intellectual property thing here, too. But
here's the deal. Most people listening to this are probably familiar with the story of Hulk Hogan banging Bubba the Love Sponge wife on camera. I mean, I think that's probably known to the majority of people who will be listening to this show.
Although shot without Hogan's knowledge, as far as we know.
Allegedly shot without Hogan's knowledge. And I think he'd be crazy for that not to be the case now, since the lawsuit he has filed
Hogan doesn't file work lawsuits.
This lawsuit
as impossible as it sounds to believe.
This lawsuit that he's filed against Gawker, who released the video at the time, this was several years back, is $100 million lawsuit.
Which doesn't necessarily mean anything, though.
Well, it doesn't.
But it does.
Other than the fact that there's no way Gawker can stay in business if that judgment is levied against.
They can't stay in business as it is now. They would sell equity something.
Yeah, I mean, so it directly affects their ability to exist. Which raises all sorts of free press questions and all that.
And I think some of that stuff's on point with the show. I don't mind talking about that.
So that's a problem in and of itself.
The FBI angle.
The FBI has, is it three different videotapes the FBI has?
They have three DVDs. Their descriptions made it sound like they were different, but they also have the same date label on them.
Yes.
And there are also audio recordings, not unrelated, but I mean, they aren't just audio recordings of the sex acts. They are of negotiations and other stuff.
Yes. So there's all sorts of
stuff
with an FBI angle here going on. And then there's also the comedy of Hulk Hogan. The judge ruling that Hulk Hogan is allowed to wear a bandana in court, but it can only be a plain bandana.
It has to be a tasteful bandana.
which I just think is absolutely hilarious. I honestly don't even know where to go. I think this is such a bizarre story. And I almost don't even know where to start with it, because it is... what's interesting is I don't know of any other celebrity sex tape scenario that has kind of gotten to this stage.
All the articles I've read said that no one knows of any celebrity sex tape lawsuit that went to trial.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, they didn't set it, since I don't think I've written this anywhere yet, they did set a new trial date.
October, right?
Well, no, they didn't actually set it yet. They will meet again in like the middle or late October to decide the trial date then.
Yeah, so the trial probably won't start till next year. But
I think it could start before the new year.
It's possible, but they I don't think they'll start.
It probably wouldn't be
it
wouldn't be till at least December, probably, and then yeah. So it could. It probably won't be until January.
So but this is it's just a crazy story. I mean, you know, if I would not recommend anybody seek this video out because you will be traumatized.
I don't even know where you can find it anymore.
I'm sure it's out there.
I'm sure it's out there, but it's probably been scrubbed a bit. I mean, well, the Vice article did mention finding it on a Howard Stern fan blog. Vice article came out last week. They did find it. Where do we start? I mean, I'll ask you, regardless of whether or not you watch the video, the lawsuit and everything makes you think that he couldn't have been aware, right? I did want to ask you that.
It's Hogan. It's Hogan. I don't. If this was almost any other person on Earth, I would say just the fact that there's a lawsuit tells you that yes, that this is.
Well, usually with Hogan, the barometer is for whether or not something is real is if there's a lawsuit.
Yeah, but I don't want to believe he'd be crazy enough to file a frivolous lawsuit of this size with this much media attention. You know, I don't want to believe that.
And Hulk Hogan files a lot of lawsuits.
I just can't say. I mean, I honestly think that if you ask me what I think is more likely, sure, I think it's more likely he had no idea. But the fact that these FBI tapes exist and that there's a lot of, you know, weirdness surrounding what's on them.
And it seems like they're making a hell of an effort not to to keep the FBI stuff out of Gawker's hands. I mean, and more, maybe even more than you'd think.
I mean, what is possible to me?
There's probably just some really embarrassing shit on the FBI stuff.
Yeah, and it's also possible, and I'd say maybe even probable, that there were some tapes that were consensual of some sorts of acts, maybe at a prior date or earlier, or you know, whatever.
But you did not know what was being recorded at that time.
In that particular instance, yes. And that could be the issue. That really can be the issue.
Well, that could certainly be an issue, I would think, for Gawker's case, yeah.
Yes. So, but we don't know. I mean, because we don't know really what the FBI has. Other than the fact that there's allegedly three different tapes. That's the extent.
Again, we don't know if it's three different tapes. There are three DVDs. The descriptions were not identical. No one said the tapes were identical. But the DVDs all have the same date on them, unless it's when Bubba or whoever burnt them. So it's either that or the FBI is being weird and making it sound like there are more videos than there are.
Yes. Which, by the way, is also possible.
Well, because the FBI is really screwing with Gawker.
Yes.
Okay, so where do we start? I mean, so do we want to just get into the case and stuff? I mean, what do you want?
Yeah, go ahead and get into the muck and the mire of the case.
Okay, so the crux – I can start with the crux of the argument of each side, which is the Hogan side should be obvious. It's various right of publicity. There's something like – What is the – I'm trying to remember. It was like something like about a law in Florida about publishing private facts, something with a little bit of wiretapping. It's, you know, basically whatever he could do to sue for this. Gawker's defense is that Hogan has made his sex life and his sexuality part of his public persona. Thus, the video itself is newsworthy. And people should remember that the article about it is up. Gawker very carefully tried to edit the video to be relevant and to make sort of the article – played into the video so that they would be covered legally. Not that I'm necessarily defending them. I mean, I don't know. I'm still not sure entirely what I feel about all that. But Gawker's saying it's that Hogan made it newsworthy. And a lot of what they're trying to find is playing into that defense. So where am I going with this? The stuff, like, I've been reading about them, like, so it's, you know, that Howard Stern interview talking about graphic sexual details with his wife, the penis size stuff that Dylan alluded to about the there's even the photo shoot he did that Hogan talked about in his first booth for, I believe it was Wee magazine, with him fondling various naked women.
You mean Brooke?
Oh. This is about 30 years ago.
But this is like my point is there were those disturbing photos of him
putting the lotion inside her thighs. Yes,
one of the most disturbing visual images I've ever seen. But yeah, that's to me, that's an interesting argument, which is like if – because what that would seem to suggest is if any public figure introduces sexuality at all into the public conversation, then there is a public interest in anything that they may do sexually to be released. You know what I mean?
Therefore, like, Jennifer Lawrence, you talked about sex once. Fuck you.
Yes. I mean, that is a real slippery slope.
Yeah, and it should be pointed out, as Gawker keeps pointing out, they did not publish any of the photos from the so-called fappening. As Nick Denton put it, it's not about the penis if the penis tells a story. Or something like that. It was something like that. I'm not making that up. And he's like, his thing is, Hogan told the lie about whether or not he ever slept with Heather Cole, about if he cheated on his wife, etc. If that date is when the tape was shot, he did cheat on Linda, although who knows what state their marriage was in at that point. But they were still married. But that is their... I don't feel good about this. I'm very much for a free press, as you would think. You are too. I just can't see. And apparently the legal expert belief is that if they don't win a trial, they could win on appeal or whatever, even if there are all sorts of issues with that because of the Florida law, because if there was a big jury award, they'd have to put up the full amount plus 2 years interest as a bond. But I just don't feel good about this. Like, why? How is that? I just don't get how that's okay. Unless you're really going on a straight up old timey law not being updated way.
I mean, it's not about the thermos. It's about the contents.
God. What is wrong with you?
I'm a bad person to be talking about this with because my politics are so crazy. But from my perspective, Gawker doesn't owe Hulk Hogan a dime. The stuff is out there. How it got out there, whether or not, you know, to me, if Hulk Hogan's suing anybody, it should be the Klims. It should be Bubba.
Because we know Bubba was showing it to people and that ended up getting stolen from him, et cetera. And he did sue the Klims as part of this lawsuit. Bubba Klim and Heather Cole, they're not, since they're divorced, and he did drop it pretty early. You know what, though? We don't know about Heather. We have no way of knowing if Heather had any involvement in the.
That's true. That's true. We don't know that. But to me, that is the party at fault.
I think I know why he settled, though. I mean, which was that Bubba transferred the copyright.
Yes. To me, the press. I'm an absolutist when it comes to this stuff. I don't think you can limit, it's one thing if we can argue about whether or not it's tasteful. We can argue whether or not it falls, it's unsound judgment, for example. We can argue about whether it's morally wrong for them to release it. I think those are all valid arguments. You could make a case that morally they should not release it. You can make a case that it's unsound judgment to release something like this on their
part. And you don't like a world where this is legal, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
However, I don't feel like you can – I don't like the precedent that would be established if Hogan wins this suit. I just think it is –
But where are you on revenge porn? Or is that different because it's not reporting media, et cetera?
Well, I mean, I
boy, I'm setting you up to look like a real asshole.
Well, no, that's fine because I don't. It's not as if I think the thing about revenge porn, like Bubba could be sued. Like I said, that doesn't bother me.
And he because
Bubba is to me the I don't know if it's criminal or not, but he's the party that has done something
most wrong.
Yes, and where there where I could see a case for compensatory damages.
I guess sort of get what you're saying. Even if Gawker, what you would say is morally wrong, they were still media acting in a media way and trying to address it in a news reporty way, even if it was still kind of sleazy in some way or whatever you want to say. I get what you're saying there. Yes.
Now don't get me wrong. There are a lot of issues that make this sort of absolutism tough. Like, what if, for example, a media outlet discovered somebody had HIV, you know, and they reported it? I don't know about that. That's tough. But it's a media. I just feel, you know, what if a wrestling reporter had found out that Abdul the Butcher had hepatitis?
That's a how do you find out thing to me. Like,
okay,
if he told another wrestler and you double source that he told other wrestlers, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that at all. If you somehow saw his medical records, that's different.
It is different because there's a privacy issue there. However, do I necessarily think that a reporter should be fired? Well, actually fired maybe. But do I think a reporter should serve jail time for that? Do I think a reporter should be...
We're not talking about jail time.
But hold on. Do I think a reporter should be monetarily liable? I don't know that I believe that. I really don't know that I believe that, even in that case. Maybe. This is tough because...
If someone at a like hospital or doctor's office leaked let's say Chuck C. Johnson type figure, would you say though that the medical professional perhaps should be maybe would deserve jail time or being fined or sued? Because of the different obligation.
Very possibly, depending on the circumstance.
Okay.
That would depend on the circumstance. It would depend on non-disclosure. It would depend on a lot of things related to that.
We're in the United States, hip is the law. So that's – I don't think there's that much wiggle room there.
I just feel like you can't
– I know what you're saying. We're still not precisely talking about laws, but so, yeah.
Here's the deal. I mean, this is a very silly example, but I feel like maybe we should mention it anyway. You know, there was a hubbub this week on wrestling Twitter, the glorious land that is wrestling Twitter, over our pals over at voicesofwrestling.com, Joe Lanza and Rich Craich. They did a podcast where they
very candidly –
very casually and offhandedly. I listen to the show every week. Joe Lanza just happened to mention that Silver Ant is actually Tracy Williams. And I will unmask him because I think this whole thing is fucking stupid. I don't care.
Oh, boy, you just screwed me.
I don't care.
I'm kidding. I really don't care. Because before we even get further, I think it's stupid that someone who is already wrestling unmasked, this would be an issue. If this is someone who just tried to have a – like if you're just trying to have a life completely away from wrestling and you just don't want anyone to know your face away from wrestling, I would understand that.
But yes. That's not what this is. And here's my problem with the way this controversy is.
I saw someone say that on – when someone was making a joke about Cage Match being at fault or whatever, was Cage Match actually listing them as the same person or was that just a joke about Cage Match combining wrestler profiles?
I actually don't know the answer to that, but here's my problem with this. Mm-hmm. I saw some people say, well, Voices of Wrestling was not acting in a reporting capacity when they did that.
Well, they weren't, but
so what? Yeah. It's a site that does occasionally break news. It happens there. And it's a podcast that has broken in, especially independent wrestling stories, several times. So even if no one knew that Tracy Williams was under the Silver Ant mask, when in fact virtually anybody who wanted to know knew.
I saw someone say, by the way, that there was a Google suggestion for if you typed in one of the names. I didn't see it myself, but
here's what's so crazy about this: the people who got up in arms about this and I'll mention them by name too because I don't care.
Brandon Stroud and Daniel Matheson.
Brandon Stroud, Daniel Matheson, who, by the way, I've defended on this show before, I might add, who has now blocked me on Twitter, even though I defended her right to piracy.
She listened to this. Come on.
I know, but still. What gets me about this more than anything is it's not as if these are like fans who are like, oh, I'm really upset because I wanted to keep the mystique. I didn't know who that was. I can almost see being upset about that.
It's like if he screwed up his life and his girlfriend is freaking out. Why?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, this completely blows my mind because
– I really don't want to get sidetracked to this too much, but I'll let you finish.
No, I feel like this. We should have probably put this on the run sheet anyway.
Yeah.
This completely blows my mind because these aren't people who are reacting – they're couching it in the rhetoric of – in some cases, particularly in the case of Stroud, they're couching it in the rhetoric of, well – if people want to keep kayfabe, they ought to be able to keep kayfabe, all this stuff. Well, you fucking people knew who he was. This doesn't affect your enjoyment at all. You knew who he was all along. Quit pretending that you're a naive fan. You're not a naive fan. You knew because a ton of people different knew. Knew. This wasn't even really traditionally reporting. Now, having said that and tying this back in to make it somewhat relevant to the Hogan case, what Joe and Rich did, even if you wanted to argue that this somehow did fuck up the life of Tracy Williams somehow, God knows how. I have no earthly idea why this would be
upsetting.
Other
than it upsetting his girlfriend for some reason.
Which and
we don't know why.
And look, maybe there's a valid reason. I have no clue what that valid reason would be unless his girlfriend's Saturine. Now, that'll get you in real trouble. But
oh, God.
There's no reason at all for this to have mattered. But let's just suppose for some reason this was a life-destroying event. Okay, I still don't think you can put that on Joe Lanza and Rich Craich because they reported a news item. Now, you can whether you think it's responsible reporting, whether you think it's irresponsible, whether you think it's moral, whether you think it's immoral, if that makes you never want to go to the site again, that whatever. But the idea that they are somehow at fault – now, don't get me wrong. I've not seen anybody say they should be sued. But the point is the idea that they are outside of the bounds of reporting by doing that just because somebody didn't want it reported, just like Hogan, I'm sure, didn't want this reported. I'm sorry. You don't get to dictate what your coverage is. That's not how this works. You don't get to decide what about your life is newsworthy. We've all had things reported about us or said about us that we don't like. You know, that's – sorry. You can't control that. And you can't control that in either case, you know. So to me, it is the idea that we should be limiting how we report things, whether it's in wrestling media or whether it's in bigger media or tabloid media, if whatever you want to call Gawker. I just think that is a terrible precedent. I don't think there's any way to defend it.
Question.
Yes.
Do you think Hogan would have sued if they only posted non-sex, non-nudity clips? I think he still would have sued, but it wouldn't have gone this far.
I think he still would have sued, but it might have been settled.
Yeah. Or it would have been turned out or something.
Yes. That's very possible. I think he would have sued almost no matter what, just because I think the issue is the fact that the act itself took place less than what is shown. You know what I mean?
That the privacy violation was not the showing them having sex, it was the showing the world the idea that they had sex.
Yes. Yes.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, so I mean what else do we need to go into here? I think if there's anything like as far as the basic facts like before the FBI thing or whatever that we need to go into. And so we talked about that it was a disgruntled employee from when he left SiriusXM. I guess a SiriusXM employee when he went back to traditional radio that I guess had a copy. Shopped it around through a sex tape broker or someone tied to a sex tape broker. But no one ended up biting on it. I mean, remember, the story came out months and months before Gawker posted their video. They got it a week before they posted it. We had known it had been around for like 6-7 months. And the person who sent it to them did it anonymously, wanted no money, wanted no acknowledgement, just wanted it out there. Which I here's a, do you think it's the same guy or do you think it's someone else?
That I don't know. That is an interesting question.
Because it wouldn't, it wouldn't be surprising more than one person had it.
More than one person
outside of the Clems had it. No. I really don't know. I mean, that's a tough one. And Gawker swears that they have no idea who it was. It was just sent to them completely anonymously. And I guess I believe them. But it's weird. I mean, it's weird that someone decided to just go straight up fuck you with it.
Yeah.
And clearly it wasn't being sold or shopped around anymore because they knew it would, that Hogan would never get the rights. But... or that Clem or whatever, that they knew it just wouldn't legally come about. But why, like, do you think it's possible then that if it was the original guy that he did it to screw Bubba? Theoretically?
There's a chance that that's the case.
Well, if it's the same guy, what else would his motive be?
I don't,
Unless he's just straight up anarchist.
That seems like... hey now, don't defame my people.
You know what I mean.
This is
not actual anarchist, colloquial anarchist.
This could be... I mean, that seems like the most likely motivation. Unless you believe it was Bubba himself.
Now, it was but hadn't Bubba been not completely, but at least somewhat open about the being in the scene, so to speak?
Yeah, I think, the thing is, though...
Well, there's knowing it and they're seeing it.
Yeah,
and they're
not
seeing
only
him tell them, hey, do your thing.
Well, yeah, not only that, but there's also the fact that, a lot of people may have thought that was just radio personality stuff.
Yes. This whole thing is just so weird. So I guess, do we talk about the FBI stuff now?
Sure.
Or is there anything else to really, I'm just thinking if there's anything else. I mean, by the way, the thing, you mentioned the bandana thing, do-rag. Is there a difference, technically? Does do-rag just refer to how it's tied? Is it inherently a different material?
I have no clue. If I had known we were going to do a podcast on do-rags, I would have invited my friend Robbie on.
Okay.
That's...
you need to ask him this, and we'll tweet it or something. Okay, so the thing as far as the him being called Terry Bollea and Cord not Hulk Hogan, that was something his lawyers requested. I mean, they requested the bandana thing too. That was the judge ruling on it. But the Terry Bollea thing was something I felt like some media framed it as something that the judge just ordered independently or that Gawker asked for. Am I alone in reading it that way?
That's how I thought it was at first until I looked more closely.
Yeah. His lawyer asked for that, and I think smartly, that this is not a cartoon character, superhero, fake pro wrestling character. This is a person.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that is a smart strategy.
Well, not only that, but the general... wrestling is treated as such a phony sideshow with everything.
Well,
I gotta say this.
Yeah, I gotta interrupt you. I've been doing on the Today in History at Wrestling Inc. I've been doing stuff about the McMahon trial the last few days, mostly from the sourcing from Wade Keller's excellent coverage in The Torch, because I believe he was the only wrestling reporter there the whole time. But he's there for jury selection, and multiple jurors not only said that it would prejudice them that wrestling was fake, but also expressed skepticism at the idea that the trial was real and speculated that the trial could be fake. And the judge And granted, that's 21 years ago, but... It would be less likely, but it still happens. Stuff like that still happens.
When I raise the objections about a potential conflict of interest between a certain reporter at perhaps doing an announcing gig, I was told over and over and over and over and over again, no, it can't be a conflict of interest. And even if it was, it doesn't matter because it's just wrestling. We don't hold this into the same standards we hold anything else. As fans, we don't. Forget the general public. You know, like even inside the bubble, we don't. I mean, look how long the Benoit murders were actually an issue for people. Not that long. And all, I mean, like, that's as horrific a thing as you can almost imagine.
Well, in the sense that some of us expected we would completely stop. Some of us did. Charles did. Our friend Charles did. But some of us expected to completely stop watching, if not all wrestling, then current wrestling.
Yeah, and not only that, but a lot of people, you know, the mentality was, Congress is really going to crack down. You know, I mean, there was a feeling that this is it. This wrestling has finally screwed the pooch. Now they're going to pay the piper for all the drug abuse issues.
Well, also because the signature pharmacy thing happened right after.
That's right.
And that was also completely by coincidence, too.
And the reality is, it didn't mean shit in the long run. You know, so
Because Waxman got moved to a different committee, basically. I mean,
If you believe that's why, I think what the real issue is that wrestling just gets let off the hook.
Actually, no. You remember what Dave wrote at the time, right?
No.
He said I don't know if this is why they gave it up. I think he might have said something like, okay, no one quote me on this. He said something to the effect of they were concerned almost to the point of not wanting to dig in too much, that wrestling was much more screwed up than they realized.
That could be.
I don't know why that means you drop it, but is this a good time to bring up that it may turn out that the hiding of the cause behind the Daniel Bryan and Tyson Kidd injuries may have actually been Total Divas stuff and not actually WWE hiding the cause of the injuries? And I'm not saying this as a slight to any fine wrestling reporters, but after last night, it sure sounds like that. It looks like that, doesn't it? After the Total Divas season coming, the season package, right?
I did not see it, so you may have to give me a brief rundown.
Tyson Kidd is being relatively open about the injury, even if he's not saying exactly what it is now. But in general, you know, you saw his Instagram post was what, Sunday, Monday?
Yes.
About, you know, only 5% of people surviving his injury, whatever it was. They showed stuff about the injury. I think they showed like a very quick shot of Joe hitting the muscle buster on him and then something. And then they, also in the new episode, even before the preview for the rest of the season, they showed this weird, out of context, ominous clip of Nikki and Brie watching Harper suplex Brian on his head. And then later in the season, they show Brian telling Brie that he's not cleared to wrestle and says it in a vague, somewhat permanent sounding way. And I was told Mike Johnson said today that now he's considered the same as Christian.
Yeah, the Christian treatment is the rumor.
Yeah, which they did actually say Christian's retired, although it took a long time.
Yes.
Which, that's a whole nother thing. But based on what I said, doesn't it sound like it's at least possible that it turned out this was Total Divas confidentiality?
It could be.
Which, I'm not saying this is a slight to Mike Johnson or to Dave Meltzer or anyone, because if no one said otherwise, like, I'm not sure exactly what they were told. I'm sure I could ask Dave off the record, but it's possible that you could want someone. It's possible that it's just a weird. You know what? No one could have expected that, though.
No.
Even if. If you took like hours to think about it, you probably could have eventually thought of that. I can see why it wouldn't have. I can see why it would have escaped everyone.
Yes, you're just privately brainstorming on that particular issue and nothing else.
Yes, exactly.
Else,
like, why are they not these two specific injuries? But one's not a concussion. Oh, right, they're both on Total Divas. Anyway, Hulk Hogan. So the FBI. So what do you know about the FBI? Well, did you read my article in Figure 4?
I did not read your article in Figure 4.
Shame.
I usually do. I'm actually, full disclosure, I am between subscriptions. I cut out all unnecessary spending as I relocated
So I like way off on that's the reason I my sub is up there, which will also change on Friday. So I did not read it, but I'm sure it's a wonderful piece.
Thank you. So what do you know about the FBI stuff?
Not that much.
Some about it on Wrestling Inc. too. That doesn't cost anything.
Look at this guy. Just shameless.
Okay. So last November – no. I think it started November 2013. Gawker files a Freedom of Information Act request for the records of the FBI investigation to the sex tape. They say no on privacy grounds. Eventually, it takes like a year. They get a release of some kind from Hogan. Heather Cole provided one voluntarily. They refile. Obviously, at this point, there should be no issue, right? Wrong. They used a law enforcement exemption saying there was an ongoing investigation. A, why did they change the reasoning? B, what ongoing investigation? So, in May, they sued. Judge Gate ruled in their favor within a few weeks. That should have been the end. FBI is screwing with them in terms of giving them stuff. There was, for example, an email from the FBI to Hogan's lawyer that talked about evidence. It's how we know pretty much for sure that they that Hogan bought the copyright, or at least got the copyright in the settlement, because there's something about a rights transfer. It's how we know that they paid Keith Davidson, the lawyer involved with the sex tape broker, $150,000. It's how we know that there are three things. I think it was one of the reasons we knew there were three DVDs, or at least that there were three DVDs with slightly different labels. The FBI filed that in the lawsuit. When they started slowly releasing documents after the judge ordered them to do it, Dylan, why didn't you guess what the FBI did?
I have no clue what the expert
think about FBI. This for a second. After I specifically mentioned a specific document that would come out that would probably also come out in the FOIA request, what could the FBI do to then screw them when sending out the documents?
Or did they redact everything?
They redacted the same document they already sent them unredacted.
Oh yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. Record. I mean, if you're in the line of research and study that I do, into completely independent of pro wrestling, redact and then unredact and vice versa is so common, it's actually amazing. But very, very common.
Yeah. So, I mean, just lots of stuff, like saying that they had to edit certain people from both the video and the audio recordings, one being Bubba on the DVDs, the other being Keith Davidson on the audio, even though everyone knows it's Bubba, at least, you know, on the first video. He said it was him. Keith Davidson, they basically acknowledged that it was him in some of the filings. So... Now, even if we don't necessarily agree legally what exactly the stuff would be, you know, as far as Gawker Hogan v. Balea v. Gawker, boy, the FBI is totally screwing over Gawker here. Agree?
Yes. It certainly seems
that way. I think they dubbed audio from the wrong thing when redacted. Like, there's something that is like, I'd have to look again to remember all of it, because there's a lot and it's confusing and complicated, but they like, there was one of the audio recordings is, I believe, Hogan's lawyer and Keith Davidson watching the video has that as part of it, and that has part of the video that Gawker ends appearing that is not in the video, or got dubbed with something from one of the other videos, I think is what happened. So it doesn't surprise me necessarily, but it's a little surprising to me that they're so stupidly obvious about it, especially when the judge has not been ruling in their favor at all. It's the FBI.
Yeah. I mean, that's honestly the best way to put it. It doesn't surprise me at all.
Maybe not surprised, but you get what I'm saying.
Yes.
I'm trying to think. So what else has been going on with that? I just remembered something good that I forgot. What was it? There, so yeah, dubbing stuff. Just all sorts of things. Oh, so when the judge made the order that you need to turn this stuff over pronto, they were asserting the law enforcement exemption. They were saying there is an ongoing or investigation, or maybe it just ended, whatever, from a law enforcement agency, and that they were asserting privilege on which agency it was. So think about that for a second. And so they, the judge was like, no, if you have to tell me, we'll empty the courtroom and get rid of Gawker's lawyers, but you have to tell me. And whatever it was clearly did not compel the judge one iota. And then now later, as Gawker got more impatient, they're basically saying that they think Hogan got a friend in local law enforcement to officially reopen an open investigation so the FBI could apply the law enforcement exemption. Which sounds like it's the most likely scenario, no?
Yeah, I think that, what else could it be?
Yeah, I mean, you see, here's the thing, though. I mean, why are they then asserting the privilege? Because they think there would be a corruption investigation if it came out if it was Pinellas County Sheriff or whatever the hell?
It's very possible.
Yeah. Inevitably, though, Gawker will get the stuff, I would think, right?
They're going to have to. I don't see how there's any way they can't.
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to eventually, I think it'll be fought. That'll be fought. So, because the problem is that leaves such a huge grounds for appeal, even if they do lose the suit. So,
right. I mean, this is going to, right. This gives them grounds for appeal with if they lose the suit to Hogan, because this is important evidence that by all rights they should have. And even if I don't necessarily sympathize with them with Hogan, I really do sympathize with them here, because just as being able to put up their best defense as media, etc., this is something I fully sympathize with.
Yeah, 100%.
Their efforts to get this information. It is just such a... It is, the whole thing is a big mess. Now, I do think, based on the way the media coverage was ramping up so much, when it seemed like the trial was going to start this week, I expect that once the trial happens, it is going to be gigantic.
Oh, I think it'll be a huge media trial, and it could be a potentially precedent-setting trial, like we said.
I think this could even be, in terms of media coverage, this could even, in terms of during the trial, I think it could end up being bigger than the Jesse Ventura, Chris Kyle case.
Oh, I actually anticipate that it will be, because it involves sex and Americans love sex.
Yes.
Like
that was just a straight-up defamation case that, because it was Chris Kyle, that people didn't really understand the actual facts. Like people saying he sued the widow, when no, he sued Chris Kyle when he was alive, and he continued the case against the estate.
Yes,
like all that stuff, and that is a fascinating case. Like, it was about a year ago that the trial happened.
That wound out. Yep.
And then I was looking stuff up. There was an article I did not read until like a week or two ago that Slate did, kind of going over it. And now also, he's suing the publisher, which is really a must-read just to understand all this. Because, like, once you win a defamation case, if you sue someone else for the same defamation, like the publisher, which he's doing, and he has every right to do, they can't argue the facts of the case anymore. They can't. It's all about everything else, like the degree of everything. Like, they can't argue that Ventura's version is not true.
Yeah, because the facts of the case have already been established.
Yeah. That's going to be really interesting to follow, too. I mean, even though it was not a unanimous verdict, it was the two sides deciding they'd be okay with a majority verdict. That whole thing's fascinating. Who was it? Was HarperCollins, right?
I believe so.
That they really, I mean, it came out in the case, they did not do a good job vetting this. They let him say it was Ventura in interviews, which, if he didn't say it was Ventura in the interviews, there probably would have been no case, because he did not say it was Ventura in the book. Although now the current versions don't have the passage at all. But it's Chris Kyle. I mean, he not to speak ill of the dead, but he told a lot of stories.
Yes.
My favorite actually being the going to the roof, going to post Katrina New Orleans, going to the roof of the Superdome, setting up his sniper rifle, and picking off looters.
yeah. Some people like to lie. So I don't even know what else to say.
Not unlike Hulk Hogan, but in this case,
no, very similar to Hulk Hogan. Actually, in fact, I think you could argue that they're analogous in many ways.
Both are American heroes. At least theoretically. Anything else we really need to talk about? But I mean, what were your thoughts on the? I'm guessing not really any different than mine on the Kyle Ventura case. Pretty much straight up, he lied. He used it to make money. Ergo, Jesse absolutely should have won. Correct?
Yep. He got burned. He got caught in a lie. It was, you know,
and it was the way he decorated it. Go ahead.
No, yes.
He said because there was a specific like SEAL. It was a SEAL's graduation event. He said that they were like both at it, or he heard about it because that Jesse was at it, and he had a black eye, and people were asking like, who beat the shit out of you, or who beat the shit out of him? No black eye. Said he had, even in general he did not have black eye, and Jesse had proof he was on blood thinners, and all the photos, media photos of him from around then, showed no black eye. I think this would have been probably an even bigger media story if Chris Kyle was still alive, in the sense of there would not have been the giant outpouring of sympathy and, you know, Durher, he's suing a war widow, or even though, you know, she's not technically a war widow, but you know what I mean. That whole thing, like, none of that would have happened. People would not have been as gun-shy in reporting on it. I mean, not that they were. I mean, it was still a giant news story, but it was not covered the way it should have been.
No, not at all.
And, you know, Jesse's a weird guy, but good for him. For being, for being able to prosecute, being able to see that through on a... You know what, though? I mean, I'm sure he can afford great lawyers, but this was honestly such an obvious case that it wouldn't shock me if he got a contingency on it. Not contingency, but did not have to outlay that much of his money.
That's very possible.
Probably not a straight contingency, but yeah. Because he had a very expensive lawyer. He had a very high-profile lawyer. David Olson, right?
Yes.
Yes. Not to be confused with Ted Olson, but... Actually, wait. Who's the Supreme Court lawyer? Ted Olson?
Ted Olson was Solicitor General, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. So... And I don't think he's related or anything, but David Olson is a very well-known, high-profile litigator, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I mean, is there anything else really to say about the Hogan case other than just it'll be fascinating when it goes to trial?
Nope, just keep our eye on it, because in October we're going to probably be hearing a whole shitload about it again. So
keeping my eye on the FBI stuff in the meantime, because I'm sure more is going to happen. There was something a couple days ago. There was another transcript. Those don't show up immediately, and at least the last one a few weeks, like a week and a half ago, when the judge first ordered, Gawker sent that one out to their media list. So that's why I had it. But I believe that. I don't think if that's going to show up, it won't for a little while yet. But stuff's going to keep happening, I'm sure. Yeah, I guess we're done for now. I don't know what that is in the background over there. If that is outside your house, if that's a TV, if that is...
I think it actually is my downstairs neighbor's television.
Okay, that was. Usually, stuff doesn't carry up like that. That's weird.
Well, you got to remember the house I live in now is 174 years old. So, the rules of modern building may not apply. But,
this is true. So let's see. How long did we go? We went almost 220. Great.
Yeah, it's all right. Well, let's get in our egregious plugs, because I've got a shitload of them, and I'll go ahead and do mine first. People can follow me, as always, at Dylan Waco on Twitter. That's DylanWaco. I rant and rave about Southern Independent Wrestling, which leads me to plug number two. I just released a gigantic interview with Empire Wrestling Entertainment Booker Andrew Alexander, which is available at voicesofwrestling.com. I think it's actually a remarkably honest interview. One of the most honest interviews I've ever seen in terms of somebody answering questions so thoroughly and in detail and not evading things where he easily could have.
I also did a podcast recently with Joe Gagne on Eddie Gilbert in 1990 USWA, which is in your wheelhouse as well, Vix.
Indeed.
That was quite a fun show. That's the Joe versus the World podcast, which you can find over the Coast Fan website. Dave Musgrave and I just did a wrestling culture on the Sheepherders, which is over. It's an awesome show that we did, documenting really their whole career.
Everybody doing podcasts that I would have wanted to be a part of. Shame on you.
Including the Boyd years. We did not skip over the Jonathan Boyd stuff. I had somebody ask me about that privately today. No, we covered that too.
I am partially done with that. It's very good.
That's over at PWO PTBN Podcasting Network, where also I have appeared on a bunch of reaction shows. And I looks like, if everything goes right, I will be reviewing the CZWI pay-per-view this weekend at VoicesOfWrestling.com. I've got some other stuff coming down the pike at VoicesOfWrestling.com. I've got some interviews, some similar interviews to the things I've been doing over there lately lined up. I also will be appearing on the Wazim Cast this week to argue about the G1. So that should be fun. I've got just a ton of stuff going on right now. I'm probably even forgetting stuff. I've got some people we might be interviewing for this show down the road, some people we might be interviewing for Wrestling Culture down the road. So just by all means, follow me on Twitter, because it'll be covered there at some point. So again, that's at Dylan Waco. That is DylanWaco. Thank you, Mr. Kaleidoscope. Take it away.
Okay. Guessing most people listening probably follow me on Twitter, but if not, it is at David Bix. Yes, it's still at David Bix. I only changed my Twitter display name to David Kaleidoscope for the time being. The name part, not the username part. This is at davidbix.com. If you got it through voicesofwrestling.com, if you did it the other way, check out voicesofwrestling.com. Lots of nice stuff there, although this is the only thing I do there. What else? You can get it on iTunes as well, all the usual places. I also do the Wrestling Inc. podcast now with Sean Ross app at WrestlingInc.com. You can find that on iTunes as well. What else? WrestlingObserver.com. I do some of the daily updates, but really the main thing I do is the lead story in Figure Four Weekly, which a lot of good stuff lately. Last week I did the Hogan stuff. The week before did the WWE stockholder whistleblower stuff, which actually, did you read that one? Or no, you already lapsed by then.
I did. No. I did read that.
Oh, you did see it. Okay, good. What else? But lots of good stuff lately. What else? New Fighting Spirit magazine came out as right before we recorded this, which I have the cover story on the role of the veteran in wrestling and John Cena and stuff like that. I talked to BJ Whitmer and Ricky Steamboat for it, and it came out really well, and that was fun. Is that about it for me as far as plugs, right now at least? Oh, and WrestlingInc.com. I do some new stuff, usually stuff that's more in my wheelhouse, some other stuff too, but also I do Today in Wrestling History every single day there, and I try to make it, nothing against the other people who do Today in Wrestling History stuff, but I try to make it a little more of a, I try to pick a few things and write about it as opposed to just listing everything. So, though you can check that out too, and I think that's all my stuff, right?
You got everything in that I can think of.
At least anything that I can talk about right now or that's up right now. Yeah.
Yes. We've all got state secrets we have to protect.
Yes.
But with that in mind, I am going to give the wrap signal. I want to thank everybody for listening. This was – yeah, it was a long show. We ain't done one in a while, and we covered, I think, a pretty diverse group of things on this show. We will be back sooner than we were last time. Next time might be an interview. I don't know. There's at least one person, maybe even two, I have in mind for this show.
You haven't told me about this yet, so we need to talk when we're done.
Think would be a good idea. So we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But in the meantime, thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the plethora of stuff that both David and I have coming in the future.
So long. I'm just talking after. I just wanted to see if people were press stop immediately, because I'm just transfixed by the background noise from Dylan's neighbor. For Dylan Hales, I am David Kaleidoscope. So long.